if we can get started. So I wanted to get her going with Zoom. Tesla join this computer audio. Okay, so she's now.
Meeting to order on April 27th. We had a couple of people that made comments that sent those to us prior to the meeting, but we didn't have anyone that signed up to speak during the meeting this evening. So we won't have any additional business from the audience tonight because no one has signed up for that. I'll go ahead and open the work session. Do we have any agenda additions or corrections?
No. Actually, Mayor, we do. Today, we'd like to switch the order around so the utility rate study check-in will go after the local state of emergency, but that's the only correction.
Okay, great. So the first discussion item is the City of Hood River's local state of emergency declaration. Rachel?
Yeah, thank you, Mayor, Councilors. Before we get started, I did ask the police chief and the fire chief if they'd be willing to just share what they're seeing from an operational perspective. So how about police chief, Chief Holste, if you'd like to share a couple for a couple minutes, that'd be great.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Rachel. It's been kind of unique times with the COVID-19. We definitely are kind of changing the way we do things. As when we get dispatch calls, we have kind of a protocol where dispatch actually lets us know medical screening before we even arrived any kind of call right now, which is very nice for us. We kind of know what we're getting into when we get there. All staff has got the proper PPE that's in their vehicles and utilize them when they need them. We're trying to handle calls related that we don't have to make contact via phone. It's kind of unique because we've always been a small rural community where we love to touch bases one-on-one with individuals, but it's kind of been our best protocol at this time for those that we can actually reach out via phone. And the citizens have been good about stating that I can take a phone call in lieu of coming to response, which has been great for us. Early on in this COVID incident, NorCorps definitely pulled back and made some major restrictions. It was some only major crimes that we were allowed to and continue to allow to incarcerate and take them to NorCorps. That's kind of unique. We've been pretty open in the years past. You've committed a crime, you go to jail if it was substantiated that. Now it's major 11 and major crimes. So definitely everything else is cite and release. Regards to the call load, I kind of pulled back and to see what we were at April of last year compared to this year. We're down about 51% of call load as far as we're related. Some of the things that we have seen increase though is we're up 16% on theft. up 66% on disorderly conduct calls, alarm calls, which is kind of unique, but it's not, 166% due to establishments closed and those false alarms that we have to respond to. We are seeing crashes down by 80%. Harassment calls are down by 52%. In turn of that, though, our calls have been down. Our arrest rate has actually stayed pretty status quo. We haven't seen that drop. We've seen a unique bump in thefts in our community. It's been up by 100%. Disorderly conduct arrests by 50%. And even our drug arrests have been up by 14% during the last 3.5-4 weeks. Minor possessions also have been increased due to probably no school. No college, more in the community at this time. So the good side of that is our DUIs and such forth, they're down about 63% from this time last year. So overall, we're status quo. Everybody's healthy, which has been good to see. Appropriate requirements as far as cleaning the station continually and vehicles. So that's all I have to offer if you guys have any questions or anything. Jessica.
I have one question.
Kate.
Yeah. The disorderly conduct, is that more domestic issues in homes kind of a thing or what? No.
No, it's not. Disorderly conduct is causing a disruption, an alert with outside the community. Drunkenness, loitering, those are all kind of classified as a disorderly conduct. Your domestic violence would be classified under your domestic house-to-house spouses.
And you said that one was down because that's the one I was worried about. We've heard of concerns.
We haven't seen a rise in that in our community. It's our biggest one is probably theft for us right now, and that's everything from grocery stores to. There's less people on the streets as far as community members and kind of those watchful eyes, and people tend to take advantage of those bicycles and such that are vehicles that are left open. So that's what we're seeing a definitely increase on.
So I know this is like the unprecedented event, but the stuff you're seeing, is it what you would kind of expect given the scenarios we're in, or are there causes for concern?
No, it's kind of like what you would see. Even during the holiday seasons, I always say theft goes up due to the fact as we get more relaxed, we're thinking of holidays, we leave things out, vehicles unlocked, and so forth. So it's pretty much of a common trend. Those type of people take advantage of situations like this, and that's what's happening.
Hi, Neil. I just wanted to thank you and all of our other officers during this time as essential workers being the first line. So thank you all for your time. You mentioned that everyone has PPE equipment and wears it when needed. Does that mean that officers, when they are reporting to someone's home, do they have a mask on or typically they don't?
Well, our ultimate goal is to give social distancing. No matter if we go there or not, we give the 6-foot-plus rule, try to contact people outside. That's a discretion on the officer. I'm not mandating that because there's already protocols pre-going to that call as far as whether they have symptoms. And it's a checklist from everything. Have you traveled out of state? Anybody in your household traveled out of state? Do you have fever? Have you had a fever? So forth. So we have a pretty good checklist upon entering or going to someone's establishment or home.
The only reason I bring that up is because, there are asymptomatic carriers and simply wondering what the precautions are right now for our officers.
Yeah, our number one thing is distance. And there's times in our job, we definitely, even now, we've had to hands-on with people. So unfortunately, there's just times where it's unpreventable.
Eric?
Hi, Chief. Hey, thanks for all you are doing. My question relates to the specific COVID rules the council has established relative to parks and hotels. And I'm just curious if you are seeing that as part of your charge to enforce those. And if so, if you've, are you actually citing people on either anything relating to a park or the closure of the hotels?
You know, ultimately, when the governor had the declaration, her ultimate goal to all police chiefs and sheriff's associations was to warn. Her goal was to educate, and that was the number one priority by her behalf or her choosing out of her office. And that's where we have stood, is education. People have been very good about, once we've addressed it, that they've social distance. We have gotten several calls for the waterfront area. Our office respond just this weekend, and there is people there, but there are social distancing, and we felt that it wasn't a need to address it due to the fact that they were spread out. And how do we dictate a husband and wife or kids related to our family members? So.
Thank you.
Okay, seeing no more questions, Chief Damien. Thank you, Chief.
Hello. Thanks for the opportunity. I'll echo the sentiments that Chief Holstey had said. The priority of our crews are number one. So we have, just like he had also stated, the dispatch center, it starts with a COVID discussion before we ever go en route, so that it just helps us with situational awareness. So that's been our number one priority, is making sure crews are safe. Luckily for us, years ago, SARS and Ebola kind of gave us a little wake up for pandemics, and we did a bunch of preparation. Thankfully, the community never needed it until now. So Dr. Benzinger and Providence Hospital's ER doctor helped us rewrite our protocol, which was a very simple add-in for us. But to answer Councilor Rivera's question about PPE, we only send one person in to a medical call. We call them like a scout. So they're the ones that are wearing everything, and everyone else stays outside unless needed. Ideally, we bring everybody outside, but that's just for us, so we don't use the precious PPE on every single call. It's just one person wearing it if needed. But I did want to say publicly thank you to Maui Myers and his group. He and his group were able to build us a bunch of PPE. And so it looks really weird to wear Tyvek house wrap on medical calls, but that's something to behold. But it's definitely keeping our crew safe, and we definitely appreciate the public involvement, and especially Maui Myers and his group. So a big thank you to him. But to supplement what the chief of police had said, a lot of it has been collaboration for the community. We're working really closely with the county. So Barb Ayers at the EOC, Trish Elliott at Public Health, and then Providence Hood River with the ER staff, as well as the facilities person, to get the surge tent up and kind of have a plan should we have a surge in our community and what to do when we have to respond to that. But operational impacts, just to answer some of the other questions about like disinfectant, we are making sure everyone does the temperature checks twice a day. That's been going on for almost a month now. And then more stringent decontamination procedures, not just the ambulance and the equipment we use with people, but also the station as well as the personnel. So we're very keen on that. And rest assured that we do have plans in place should we have a breakout or one of our employees, which thankfully we don't have anybody sick. If that ever happens, we have plans in place should we have to expand that further. As far as call volume goes, we're business as usual. We're probably about 0.89 calls down a day from the beginning of the year. And just like Neil had said, we're still going on false alarms as well, since businesses are not occupied. But we're still doing interfacility transfers to Portland. We're still running 911 calls, and we're not quite one call a down average per day. So that's it, unless you guys have questions.
Any questions? Thank you, Chief.
All right, thank you for your time.
Great, thank you, Mayor, Councilors. Thanks to our chiefs and all our crews out there in the field. Mayor, we have a placeholder here for discussion of the city's emergency declaration. It is my intention to extend the emergency declaration to May 14th. Key provisions of that declaration include the suspension of utility shutoffs, suspension of late fines for payments, city facilities remain closed to the public, and city resources are being redirected to the community response. In collaboration with other park providers and consistent with the governor's orders, we are able to open neighborhood parks. Playgrounds and restrooms are closed, but the green spaces in neighborhood parks could be opened. Waterfront Park and the Children's Park would remain closed. Unless directed otherwise by council, short-term lodging and bans on recreational and leisure hotel stays would remain in place for the duration of the emergency. And with regards to travel, the governor's order is clear that non-essential travel is prohibited, and the mayor's order is consistent with this. Finally, the governor's reopening framework will guide any future decisions about the emergency declaration. So with that, I will turn it over to council for discussion.
Okay. I think I'd like to just take the temperature on the first part of the order, not including the parks and not including the hotels, motels, and short-term rentals. Just regarding the utility shutoffs and social distancing and having people work for the city work from home if they need to, and kind of see if council thinks that we should continue that until the middle of the month. And then let's take those other two subjects separately, because there might be more discussion on those, I'm feeling. So let's just see how many people are in agreement with keeping the order as it is for those things that don't have to do with the parks or the hotels, motels, and short-term rentals. If you could raise your hand if you want to keep those in place. Okay, I think, Eric, are you a yes on that?
I think I am a yes. I just, a point of clarification, when you were listing those things, I wonder if you could clarify, and I don't know if you referenced restaurants, but we're following the governor's order on restaurants, right? We're not doing more or less locally. Is that correct?
That's correct. And the city does not regulate restaurants.
That's what I thought. I just wanted to make sure I was understanding.
That's correct. Yeah.
Thank you. I guess we don't have any control over that. I'm a yes.
Well, we're on. Okay. Sorry.
No, go ahead, Megan.
I obviously am in support of those things. I'm just wondering, since we're on that topic, of if we can do another blast or get some more information out about the, you know, no utility shutoffs or late payments, to really harp on folks that are struggling, that they can maybe breathe a little bit easier with what we've got available.
Sure, Councillor, that's great. Thanks for the feedback. We'd be happy to add that to the next e-blast.
Okay, and I also, everyone else has said yes, I also agree that we should continue our emergency resolution in regard to those things. So let's take the parks next, because that is something that the city on its own did make a rule about, and now we're talking about the possibility of people being able to use green spaces and or trails, but nothing that has to do with like children's play equipment that you might have to clean, or restrooms which you might have to clean, with social distancing still in place for that. So does anyone want to start with thoughts on that? Mark?
The space bar thing didn't work that time. That's really funny. Okay. so much for a good idea. So I'm hip to what we were talking about, and opening up the trails and parts of other parks, like what you're saying. I guess my question is related to signage and coordination with other entities. Is, you know, how are we signing that the waterfront trail is open, but the part of the waterfront park is not. How are we signing, you know, Indian Creek Trail and other and things like that? I think the important bit is clear communication, and hopefully the same communication that all the entities are doing. The port being the key partner at the waterfront, and parks being key partner for those other trail systems.
Yeah, thank you for the question, Counselor. I have been in contact with the other entities, and we've collaborated on a sign. The basic theme for the sign is crowds equals closures. So, and all the entities plan to use that sign. As you probably know, the county has already made the decision to open up some of their trail network. So in this case, we would be consistent with that. The Parks and Rec trails, so the Indian Creek Trail and the West Side Trail have remained open throughout the emergency declaration, and the Waterfront Trail has remained open. I do think the waterfront is going to be a particular and ongoing challenge for all of us. So that area is going to take, as you heard Chief Holstie say, it's going to take all of us working together to communicate that crowds equals closures. And at this point, we do not feel confident that we can effectively, that we can safely manage the crowds in the green spaces at the waterfront park. So that's the approach that we're taking, and we will see what happens.
I'm going to take that segue, maybe. In the obviously having some green space available to the community is super valuable. And I think keeping the waterfront closed is unfortunately super necessary given the regional draw of that. I am just wondering, like, what has been the thought so far? How will we deal with just the, like, any sort of partial reopening does feel like an invitation for more people to come here? Or, you know, as we get nicer weather of everyone wanting to get out, which I understand of. I love the crowds equals closures signage, but if there's like really clear messaging we can continue to have for folks across the river or Portland or anywhere else, this is not an opening. I guess what has been the thoughts, or can we do that?
Happy to continue to communicate, you know, whatever is necessary to limit crowds. We've been communicating public health guidelines. We'll continue to align with County Public Health and Oregon Health Authority on physical distance requirements. We'll continue to do more of the same, and we're ready to adapt our communication should we need to. Absolutely.
I think that the state suggestion, or not, I would call it a suggestion because it's not a law, so to speak, is that you're supposed to stay home. You know, they aren't stopping people on the freeway to see what their address is, or stopping people when they come off of X62 to see who they are, but the message is supposed to be stay home. So I don't think anybody's being told to go home if they're continuing to do social distancing, if we see them on the street downtown or in the park. I don't believe there is an order that says that we can even do that. And there is no constitutional law that says we can do that in Oregon. So I think we just have to do our best and just remind people what they're supposed to be doing. They need to be moving along and not standing in groups. If you want to walk down there, that's great, but there shouldn't be big groups of people, and it'll be closed if it starts to happen, whether you live here or don't.
And just to clarify, this the park guidance is consistent with the governor's guidance. In other areas, parks remain open. So we are aligning our restrictions with the governor's order with regards to neighborhood parks. And for those facilities that are more attractive, those will remain closed, as will playgrounds per the governor's orders.
So Rachel, I have a question about Waterfront Park. If we have the trails open in Waterfront Park, I would assume that would constitute the paved areas where the sidewalks are. And so would being tape around the grassy areas and the children's play structures, is that how we would do that?
No, Mayor, it's just the waterfront trail, the paved trail that has been open for walking the entire time. We will sign the waterfront park as closed as we have. So we'll keep consistent signage. We can add some more signage to the area, but the entire area of the park is closed.
I'll speak for myself, but I think some extra or more clear signage would be useful, because even the existing signage, I did not know the trail was still open, or I thought it was it was not clear. So if we can have very clear messaging of any grassy area is still closed, but you can walk the trail. Sorry, I know Tim's been trying to speak for a while, but thanks, Rachel.
Go ahead, Tim.
I guess my question is, I can see, for one, I think people are kind of using the neighborhood parks as it is, and I think they've been doing that in kind of a very responsible fashion. But I guess one of my questions is how is it being enforced? I mean, I don't understand, and I think that this is going to apply to other things as we go forward. What's the criteria for too much? What is the criteria for, not proper social distancing, and what do you do about it? That's part of the thing is when you open it, there's going to have to be some type of assessment about whether it's working or it's not working. And it's not really clear to me right now how that's going to happen or what the criteria are.
Mayor and councilors, we will continue to use education and voluntary compliance as our first option. Large crowds that don't disperse, we can take another approach. We have not seen that so far. So some of this, again, I think the message is, as the mayor said, travel is limited, crowds are limited, and we're expecting people to comply with that.
There, in the governor's order, there's like criteria for the number of people that can get together. What is that? Is that 10 now? I forget what it is.
I have the order right here. I'd have, it's either, well, I can look it up and get it to you.
Yeah, I mean, because I can easily see how there would be, and I think we've all experienced this on a personal level. Is that when you're walking in, you see your neighbors, and there's their kids and their other kids, and next thing you know, you're kind of doing your best to stay socially distant, but sometimes it doesn't always work so well. So, I mean, there's those types of things. I guess that, just as long as that doesn't get any worse than what it is right now, it should be fine. But I guess I'm just expressing some of my concerns.
Yeah, and I would also say, Counselor, we took swift action when the crowds did get out of control the last time.
Thank you.
Eric?
Yes, thank you, Mayor, and thank you, City Manager. I really commend this decision. I know there's a lot of balancing that has to go on in all these decisions, and we're all making a lot of sacrifices. But one way to think about it is all we as the community have really had to be outside is just the sidewalks. I never realized how wonderful sidewalks can be. But I think, given the data and given the whole situation as it stands now, and given the public comments that I think we all know we've received on this, opening up the neighborhood parks is really the right thing to do. I think we can put trust in our community. We have a very responsible and community-minded community, and I think we can put some faith in people. So I see this as a step in the right direction. And I also, and I just feel like the city manager is empowered to change directions if we get a few days into this and it just isn't working. I think the messaging should be that, you know, this is not, doesn't mean party in the park. It just means, you know, our family units can go into the green spaces in the park, and we have to strictly socially distance. We're not talking about parties. We're just talking about expanding the public square right now beyond the mere sidewalk into our other neighborhood assets. One very small little data point I'll mention on the stairs, which isn't really a park, but I have gotten some comments from people that the signage there could be a little bit bigger. And people, I think, are unintentionally not following the rules on the stairs because they're a little hard to see. So I just mentioned that because people had mentioned that to me. And then the last thing I'll mention is consistent with what I understand the county has done, and people can correct me if I'm wrong, but this notion of it's sort of drive, it's walk only, walk or bike only. You're not to drive to these neighborhood parks. That might be one way, if we included that as a condition, of encouraging or having the result be that this is more locals only, rather than out of towners, if you are required to walk or bike and not use a car to get there. Just an idea.
Thank you, Counselor. I'll take that back to the group. That's a great idea.
Additional, Jessica, and then Mark.
Thank you. I was just going to say that I do support opening the green space at our parks. I particularly think that it would be helpful for some of our low-income families that have limited access to green space at all. And thinking about them, I do think that maybe some of them would probably end up driving their car to some of the parks that have larger green spaces potentially if they, if the one that's closest to them is crowded all the time. So I don't know how to balance that, but in general, I think this would be useful for our families, and I appreciate what Councillor Haney had said about Rachel's discretion to change the rule if the crowding happens. I like the message, the sign that Mark Hickok came up with was great, with the crowds equal closures. Did we lose the mayor?
Lost the mayor.
Well, Council President, it looks like.
Okay, I'll just,
It looks like Councilor Rivera also wanted to speak.
Since I already had my turn, Gladys, why don't you go first?
I just wanted to mention, I did see the sign. Thank you, Mark, right? The gentleman who helped create the sign. To be honest though, I really feel that the Spanish translation, if there's a friendlier way of saying, or just plain language, some of the terms are a little complicated. So if that could be changed or just addressed, I would highly appreciate it. And also, is this going to end up in a, you know, PSA on Radio Tierra to let Latino families know that the trails are opened?
Sure, we can certainly suggest that to the group and make that happen. Absolutely, thank you for the suggestion. And I'd be happy to run the translation by some of our staff as well. It was our staff that helped with
one part that
translates. So
it says parques senderos. I mean, that technically means bridges. So, you know, that could cause confusion.
Sure. Yeah, we'll take another look. Absolutely. Thanks for the feedback.
So my last question is that I get a lot of questions about water access. We do have the ramp at Waterfront Park. Is that part of the trail or is that part of the park? I don't know. Do we know what the port is doing for access to the spit or their event site? And as much for just are we clearly communicating? I want to be able to communicate what's open and what's not open as clearly as possible. So water access is a big question that we're getting, and or I'm getting anyway. And so just knowing what the story is for that would be great.
Yeah, thank you, Counselor. Thanks, appreciate that question. We'll be sure to get that information out. I believe the port's gonna talk about it on Wednesday. So, but we're in, like I said, all the providers have a weekly call and we can talk about it then and get that list out.
Okay, I'm having all sorts of issues with bandwidth, but
looks like we lost the mayor again.
I think there's an audio call-in option. I don't know if someone can text her the phone number.
Yeah, we'll get her some. There she is. Yeah, she didn't before though, so.
Kate, you're on mute.
Yeah, if someone could text. Can you hear me now?
Yeah,
we can hear me.
We can hear you, Mayor, and we will get you some. We will get you a call-in number, make this a little bit easier.
Can you hear me?
We can, Mayor. Jonathan should be getting you that call-in number. Do you have your invite? It's on your invite. If not, he's going to text you a call-in number so you have it.
Okay. Well, I'll continue. Now I can see everyone. Can you hear me?
We can.
All right, well, yeah, if you text that to me, that'd be great because who knows how long this is gonna last. Was there anyone else that wanted to talk about the trails and the open space? I don't see anyone. Okay, so are people in general agreeing, from everyone that has spoken, it sounds like people are in agreement in general to give this a try to open up the trails and the green space in the smaller parks. Give me a thumbs up if you are good on that. Okay, everyone here, just for the record, is giving me a thumbs up to open the trails and the green space in the smaller parks. So hotels, motels, and short-term rentals. I've definitely got some thoughts on it, but I'm sure others do too. Does anyone want to start? Tim.
I guess my question is what's really changed from when we implemented the regulation in the first place? And I think that, you know, having sat in on the governor's reopening strategy, you know, I think there are some things there that we should take to heart. And some type of criteria that we could use to actually make a decision along those lines. And for me, you know, the short-term rentals and the hotels and motels are one of the things that would potentially bring more people from outside the community into our community. So I think that it's definitely a different decision point for me with as opposed to what we just talked about with the parks, which really is kind of more how do we, you know, it's more of a locals issue. So I guess those are kind of my opening thoughts on that. And that, you know, when I listened to the governor, there was some type of, you know, incorporation of the epidemiological data where you're having a downward trend in infections. You know, there is some consideration of, you know, whether the county health department is prepared, whether the hospitals are prepared. I think all of those things to me seem to play into that decision for me personally.
Yes, I'll go. I think given where we are at right now, and with the governor's still in effect order of, you know, no non-essential travel, unless I'm missing something, basically our order says people who don't have an essential reason to be here shouldn't be here, which, you know, is basically the same thing, but in slightly different words to the governors. And I don't see that we are ready to change that, or that the governor's ready to change that at this point.
So just weighing in, I also don't think right now is the time, because it only adds risk, because we'd be bringing in new people and there's nothing we're inviting them to come and do, you know, no restaurants or things like that. I am empathetic to that big part of the community though that counts on tourism. So I guess I'm curious about both, you know, am I messaging it properly to say what, you know, what are we doing? What is the roadmap to opening it? And some of that is in the three-phase thing that's outlined by the governor. But for us, you know, just having that status, you know, until we have test and trace in place in the county, and that's not a city thing, can we do it? You know, if until the state parks open, can, you know, is it wise to do it? There's a bunch of, I have way more questions and not very much in the way of suggestions, I'm afraid. So what is the discussion process that leads us to an intelligent decision policy-wise? That's my biggest summary question.
I guess I completely agree with what everybody has said. We need a data-driven response, and it's hard being, you know, having our day jobs and not being experts to really know how to know when it's time. I do feel like, having said that, you know, if we can take at least some baby steps toward whatever the new normal is going to be, I certainly would be open to that. You know, one thing that comes to mind, and this is almost just a micro step, but you remember there is a bit of a gap between the language of our resolution and sort of what the actual enforcement practice is going to be. And that I sort of worked in the heat of the moment when we were first putting that together. But now that we've had a little bit of time to put that together, I just wonder if we need to have a more straightforward, less draconian sort of way of phrasing it. I mean, I think what we're really trying to do here is not have people come here to recreate. And, you know, and the person that comes to mind, I've mentioned this a couple of times, I think, is sort of the one night traveler on their way to another destination who is not here to recreate, but is here to just stay the night in a hotel rather than in their car or something like that. I personally would be in favor of sort of acknowledging that as an acceptable person to not be shunned away. I've spoken with some of the hotel owners, and I understand that they are actually making inquiry. Why are you here? And if they're here to recreate, they're telling them to not, from what I'm being told, they're telling them not to stay, which is, I think, the right thing to do. But I don't know, I think we've referred to it as a mayor's opening statement a couple meetings back. If that could be kind of crafted, I think we want our enforcement practice to line up with our rule of law. I would be in favor of that.
I'll jump in. I guess my understanding was that the hotels had some leeway to talk to the people if they were driving through and really didn't have a way to continue, they could let them stay. Is that, perhaps Rachel, could you speak to that?
Sure, I'd be happy to address it. And I think Councillor Haney is correct. The actual language in the order is fairly severe. After the council discussed this, we did put out another statement that the ban was intended specifically for leisure and non-essential travel, and that we understood that the lodging partners were going to be our partners in making sure that essential workers were housed, and that we asked them to train frontline staff, as Councillor Haney mentioned, to identify legitimate reasons for an overnight stay and turning away anyone wishing to stay due to leisure activities and for non-essential reasons. So similar to the other measures, our approach has been voluntary compliance. So we could certainly take a stab at marrying those two in the next round of an emergency declaration, if that's the direction of council.
I mean, if we did the clarifying statement, have we found that folks are, they understand what they can and can't do at this point, and they are generally complying? Because it seems like just creating a new order will add more confusion as we try to clarify it.
I think that's a very good point. I've talked to, talked to Travel or Visit Hood River, and they've been a strong partner in communicating that Hood River is not open for business right now, and they're willing to continue to do that. I've talked to, as Councillor Haney suggested, lodging providers who have said it's the stay-at-home order that, has really put a damper on their business, and they're complying with that. And then I've talked to other people who would like a little more flexibility. So I think I would agree that it's not clear. I think the clearest statement has been made that non-essential travel is not permitted per the governor's order right now.
I have a question for Eric, I guess. It seemed to me, we had a good discussion about this, and the mayor's message that went along with the ordinance is sort of where my head has been, and it says basically exactly the same thing that you expressed as your goal. Do you think that we missed the mark there, or is it just a communication issue?
Well, I think the mayor's message was great to have. I guess I just look at it from the perspective of what does the black letter of the law say, and following the rule of law. I mean, if we have a disconnect between what our enforcement practice is and our rule of law, then that there's a gap there that just, and maybe this is just an academic type of an issue, but I feel like we need to have our law be what we're trying it to be, not to have the law up here and the enforcement down here. That's just not, to me, the way we need to be legislating. We want to have our laws reflect what we actually are intending to accomplish. So that's my comment there. And I guess changing topics a little bit, not intending to change topics, but since I'm speaking, I'll just say, and I don't think the time is now for this, but looking ahead in terms of maybe the next meeting or the meeting after that, what we could, things to just plant a seed and be thinking about are things like maybe having hotels or motels that are outdoor facing with the door. Maybe those could open sooner rather than others. Or maybe you can do every other room. But all those types of things will come after the governor's order for non-essential travel is lifted. So just sort of planting a seed there. But it just seems proper for our rule of law to match up with our enforcement practice to me.
And Councillor, just to clarify, we have not had an enforcement issue thanks to the support and compliance by our lodging partners. We've certainly gotten questions, but to my knowledge, there has not been an enforcement issue.
And no, I understand that. I'm just, and maybe it is academic, but the notion of if your laws say one thing and your enforcement practice is another, that's just... not the way to do
it. Yeah, understood. And I appreciate that point.
Have we gotten any calls about short-term rentals that are potentially needing of enforcement?
Will, I'm going to look to you to jump in on this one.
I only know of one that was, after investigation, was not a violation. But actually, I'll let the chief, if Chief Holsey's on here, he might have the up-to-the-minute stats on if we've had any sustained complaints. Chief, are you on here?
Yeah, you're right, Will. We only had one complaint, and that short-term rental is utilizing that as a long-term rental now. So that was the only complaint we've had.
Thank you, Will and Chief. I was just going to say that I do support continuing the mayor's message. Like my other counselors have said, I feel like it is in alignment with the governor's stay-at-home order. I also know the governor is, working at what are those safety protocols for retail and restaurants and what not to open. I haven't heard hotels being on that one, but I think it's probably because she hasn't officially said that they all had to close. But that's something that I'm happy to look into. And I also agree with Councillor Zammiller's point about maybe we could have some more input from public health on how we are set to, if we had more information about, where are we in terms of meeting our testing and contact tracing requirements and things like that, then we could maybe feel better about reopening some things.
I'll jump in. Okay. I echo Jessica's last statement there about possibly having, Trish Elliott come onto one of these calls and just inform our community members, our constituents of what the plans are now. I know that there are also additional guidelines that have not been given by the state. And I think if we are just transparent about that, just to inform our community members, why we can't reopen as fast as some of other communities are.
Yeah, I can address that a little bit. Oh, go ahead, Mayor.
Oh, I was just gonna say that I think asking Trish Elliott or asking the health department or health authority what they have to say about hotels, motels, and short-term rentals opening, because those were not in the governor's order, there probably won't be too much more guidance coming specifically from the state on that. But I think if we look at our local health authority and just ask them point blank what they think about them reopening, there's two things about them opening. And the one is, do they need PPE? Are they doing social distancing? Is everything being cleaned in between the people that are staying there? That's one issue. And that's probably what the health authority would focus on, because that's what they're going to focus on for dentist opening and hairdressers opening and those kind of things. But the bigger question is the stay at home. And so I think, until the governor says we don't have to stay home, that we should have some form of restriction on tourists coming. And that's what the hotels are for. And if it's for some other reason that we need and they're essential, then they should be able to house those people. So that's kind of my thoughts on it.
I can give an update on where the county is right now. They are working really hard to try to understand and unpack the reopening framework and what that means for Hood River County. And once that information is available, we're happy to we'll obviously communicate that to you, use all of our communication channels to communicate to the public with regards to those guidelines And as I've mentioned to council, the city remains available to support and assist the county public health in all of their efforts.
I believe that some of that information should be forthcoming in about a week and a half to 2 weeks. That's what I've heard. So I think I'm hearing, and I just want to paraphrase what I'm hearing, is people, we would like to just keep our regulations at this point regarding short-term rentals, hotels, motels being closed. And depending on how long we need to do this, if we need to potentially align the language a little bit better, I am kind of afraid to, you know, change it and then, you know, the establishments go, oh my God, now is it different? Why is it different? And it won't be any different. It'll just be aligning with the message that I read. But I think we could potentially look at that depending on how much longer we have to keep this in place. Maybe for the next meeting or the meeting after. Tim?
So I've heard the governor lifting the stay-at-home order as a potential criteria for reopening the hotels and motels and short-term rentals. And I think we need to think about and kind of develop a way that we're actually going to get past this. But what I'm hearing, though, is that really we're going to rely on the governor's and the state's guidance with respect to these issues. So the expectation that so the hotel and motel and short-term rental owners have some expectations about when or how we reopen. So is that correct? Is that a reasonable assessment of the criteria?
So what I heard when I was listening to the governor's statement, and what she was saying is, basically, I cannot give you a time frame for these things. Depending on your county, depending on the state, depending on how fast your curve goes down or goes to zero, and if you have enough PPE, those are all the criteria that will let you open or let the state open. And so she would not give a time frame. You know, everybody wants a time frame, but she's like, this disease is going to give us a time frame. Unfortunately, that's what is giving us a time frame, nothing else. Right. So she really wouldn't give us a time frame on it.
No, that makes sense to me. But can we communicate that more directly to the folks that are being affected by this? Because, I mean, that's one of the comments that I've heard is that, you know, we just don't, you know, understand what the plan is for getting past this. So maybe some additional communication might be warranted.
Yeah, and Councillor, we are going to need to rely on the county here, county mm-hmm. public health, to interpret the governor's guidelines and to tell us what it means for Hood River County. And if we can help with that with staff resources, we remain, you know, I've made that offer many times, and I'm sure they'll, you know, take us up on it if they need it. But they are the ones that will be looking at the Hood River data and communicating that.
I think there were some other hands up. No? Okay. All right, so I think let me get a thumbs up if everyone wants to keep our order in place for that, for the hotel, motel, and short-term rentals. Eric,
I guess just subject to my comments about the form of the order. And I think I'm also hearing consensus that, you know, if and when, well, not if, when the governor lifts the order, council will take prompt action to react to that, maybe even calling a special meeting if we have a big gap between that occurrence and our next meeting.
I think that's reasonable. And I think that the other thing that the governor, since the governor didn't shut hotels, motels, and short-term rentals, there may not be a whole lot of guidance particular to that when they reopen and what they should do to reopen. So we need to talk to our health authority here too when that time comes to make sure that they're doing what they need to do. All right. I also have my thumb up. So I just want to, for the record, everyone has said yes to keeping.
Mayor, just to clarify, you don't need a motion. We don't need a vote on this.
Don't need a motion.
No.
Okay. All right.
No. Thank you.
All right. All right. State of emergency. Long discussion, not long discussion, but that was good.
Can I actually add something to that discussion? since we're on coronavirus related things, this is more just throwing something out there, but I guess as I've been watching, especially federal programs are maybe limited or are taking a while to get money to both individuals and to small businesses. I'm wondering if there's some way we can, or if there's already a program locally or regionally that would do kind of the bridge loan of until you get the PPP or something like that. We can help get rent paid for the month or two gap period, or what if anything is possible in that realm? Because I definitely would hate to see that a couple months of backlog leads to a bunch of empty storefronts in town. So, and I know there definitely are smarter people than me working on this in the region, but wondering where that's at or what we could do to help.
So are you talking specifically about people that don't have PPE that need it to reopen?
Oh, sorry, PPP, the Paycheck Protection, that's really hard to say. Payroll Protection Program.
Oh, okay. I thought you were talking about personal protective equipment.
Oh, sorry, acronyms are bad.
Sorry.
That's on me.
Yeah, Mayor, Councilors, I'm happy to address that. Certainly the city could do something to help. We've been in conversations with the business community. We absolutely could. I'm not sure what that looks like yet, but we'd be happy to look. If that's your direction, we'd be happy to look at that. So.
Great, thank you. On my end, what type of direction do you need, or just like general go forth and look? Is enough?
Yeah, you know, right now we haven't had a specific ask. So again, I mean, Councillor Mehta and I have been on several calls. We have not had a specific ask to the city yet. But we would certainly be in a position, and in fact, we're in next year's budget have put aside some money for a recovery package. That's not immediate, but certainly we can look at some options there. We could look at loan programs. I think McKed would be a good entity to manage that. Absolutely. I'm happy to continue those conversations with the business community.
I was just gonna say that, yes, I had mentioned in my council call last time, maybe the time before, about how Rachel and I have had a few conversations to just talk about how the city can help with my work capacity. And it's not been clear. There's like no right answer. And I also think that it was kind of, it's good to have a conversation with this group to really say, what do we want to do if anything. I think I could share information about what's available, what maybe some other communities are doing. They're primarily grant programs, and so that I think would be the question, if the city wanted to grant money But anyway, I can do this. I'm here to be helpful.
So I think that that is a lot bigger question than we have time for, since it's really a whole new subject. And thank you for bringing it up, Megan. And thank you, Jessica, for working with Rachel and, kind of keeping it top of mind. But I think we probably need to do some more research into it at this point, what we could do, amounts of money, whether it be loans, whether it be grants, the best use. So I think that definitely we should follow up with that. Gladys had actually asked me about some possibilities for some funds for the COVID situation when we get into fall and summer and we have harvest and people need PPE. There's a lot of different possibilities that monies could be used for. So I think it's a bigger conversation and we need to just continue it at the next meeting. All right.
Can I just make the clear ask, at least for myself, if not for, mean, that's obviously up to the rest of the council if they agree, but that, yeah, if staff could bring back, options for us to maybe make some decisions on.
What is it that we're trying to accomplish? What's the goal? We're happy to look into anything.
There's probably multiple, but I could see one option is at least short-term revenue to get people through to hopefully some state or federal assistance. Potentially another option is longer-term assistance that supplements whatever state or federal is or isn't getting to our local community. But I don't want to decide everything for the rest of council either. So
I guess we would have to determine, is this individuals, is this businesses, is this money we would loan, or would it be grants? I mean, there's just so many questions that I'm not sure how how far we want to go with it tonight.
Well, let's not reinvent the wheel. This last week, the Oregon Legislature Emergency Board approved emergency funding, and they did just that, where it's designated towards rental assistance, motel vouchers, assistance programs for small businesses, survivors of domestic and sexual violence, wage replacement fund for newly unemployed workers, workers in long-term care facilities. So there are, models out there that exist that all we have to do is adopt. And obviously we don't have millions of dollars to give away, but we could replicate what's already been done out there, especially in our neighboring city, which is Portland.
Okay. I still think we need to have a bigger discussion about it, because this is something we've never taken on before, and I'm not saying we shouldn't. I'm just saying that we need more time to, and if we need to have another meeting, a special meeting, and spend another 45 minutes on this particular subject in between, we should probably think about doing that.
I was just suggesting some guidance to Rachel on, there's already
programs out there
that exist. Yeah.
So, yeah. Counselors, let me just to try to be helpful in this conversation. We have identified $250,000 for next year's budget as a recovery program. So that would give us a little bit of time to put some ideas around what a recovery program might look like. That money, that's not going to go very far if we're talking about serving everybody from domestic violence businesses, victims, to small business. So I think, staff and I are happy. We're always happy to bring great ideas to you. And if that's the direction, if you just want a great idea, then that's what we'll do. If there's something specific that council wants to try to accomplish, that's very helpful direction for us to hear. That's where we're at. That's the status right now, money in the budget for next year. If there's something, want to do something else, we will do it.
And yes. Go for it.
I guess, I think money in the budget for next year is super important and valuable. I'm wondering if there's something we can do where obviously the need is fairly immediate before July or later to provide some sort of relief.
I don't believe we can because we didn't have it in our original budget. So we would have to do a supplemental budget. Am I correct on that, Rachel, or not?
I'm not entirely due to the emergency declaration. Another option, I can continue talking to Jessica offline about this and see if there's something that we can put together. Again, I'm hearing everything from business community to, and we'll come back with some ideas. How about that?
Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you so much. All right, let us go to the utility rate study. Will.
Thank you, Honorable Mayor and City Council. So this has been a very large project that has been going on to a large extent just with staff while we do a lot of data analysis and get in capital project plans. So we wanted to have a check-in as we're continuing to move forward. We're at a good point where we've done a good analysis of the city's cost of service and how that might impact how the rate burden can be more accurately and equitably shared amongst different user groups. And so I've asked our project manager, Doug, and I believe a partner in charge, John, are both on the in the meeting with us. So I'll pass it over to them and they're gonna walk you through a discussion and then be available for questions.
Good evening, Mayor and Councilors. I'm Doug Gabbard. I'm a project manager with FCS Group and I'll be leading us through the presentation tonight. I am joined on the call by two of my colleagues. One is John Ghilarducci, who is the project principal on this engagement. He's the one who makes sure that we give you our very best work. I'm also joined by Wyatt Zimbelman, who is the analyst on this project, and he is there to help us get down into the weeds if you ask some questions that take us down that path, and I hope you will. Being mindful that there are other things on the agenda tonight, you may see more detail than you will hear coming out of my mouth. Rest assured that I am happy to go into more detail on anything you like. But as a courtesy, I want to be able to make sure that you have time for everything that you need to do this evening. This engagement is a rather comprehensive rate study. And we are not done yet. There are several line items in this table that we have made significant progress on, and those are principally the revenue requirement for the water and wastewater utilities, as well as the cost of service analyses for the water and wastewater utility, and that is mainly what we're going to be reporting to you about tonight. And after we have completed that work, there's more to do. Stormwater is the next one because stormwater is part of our larger project as well. But this is kind of an interim check-in to give you some initial results and let you know kind of in real time where this larger analysis is going. So this is a comprehensive rate study, which means it's got multiple layers to it. When we talk about a revenue requirement, which is the first analysis we'll talk about, that is a test of the sufficiency of your current revenues and how much more revenue you need overall to make your utility work. So the output of that kind of analysis is a series of recommended annual rate adjustments that would be applied overall to the entire customer base over a multi-year period for a particular utility. Once you have that analysis in hand, you then move to the cost of service analysis, which is where you begin to disaggregate the customer base into individual customer classes. And you start looking at, is the utility collecting an appropriate amount of revenue from its single family customers? Is it collecting an appropriate amount of revenue from its multifamily, from commercial, from industrial? And we look at individual customer classes to make sure that they are sharing equitably in the needs of the utility. And so the output of that analysis will be a series of rate adjustments that are differentiated by customer class. Some may need to go up and some may need to go down, and the numbers can be all over the place. Once you do that, you still haven't answered the question of what should the rates be, because you still have to decide things like how much should we collect from volumetric rates? How much should we collect from fixed rates? Should we have tiers? Tiers, T-I-E-R. Hopefully we don't have any T-E-A-Rs. But that is the job of rate design. And that we're not to that point yet in our analyses. That is the fun stuff yet to come. So we'll begin by looking at the revenue requirement analyses for water and sewer, and let's see what those required rate increases will be. We begin with a set of assumptions that we have thoroughly rinsed with staff, and I won't go over these in detail with you. But it is a good time to remind you that we have gone over these analyses thoroughly with city staff. We've verified our assumptions to make sure they make sense. We've verified cost escalation rates, growth assumptions, and we have documents like project lists and operating budgets to make sure that we have the correct costs to model your revenue requirement. Well, when it comes to the revenue requirement, what we found is that it's the capital projects that are really driving the train here as far as rate adjustments. So for example, you're seeing here a chart of the capital funding forecast for water. You have projects that total $14.7 million over a 10-year period, and you see some highlights of what those projects are. Let me ask you, when I put my cursor on the screen, can you see my cursor moving? Okay, good. So a lot of these costs, as you can see from the colors of the chart, the blue indicates expenditures that can be covered with cash on hand, fund balance, or rate revenues earned in that particular year. And that source of funding will cover most of your capital needs. We do have one bond issuance we're planning because we need to get you over this cash hump in fiscal 2022, and that will be a $1.0 million revenue bond issuance. Which will then thereafter require about $80,000 a year in annual debt service. Now, I mentioned that it's really capital that is driving the train, and here's proof of that. On this stacked column chart, you'll see the layers of cost of your water utility. We're still on water here. The dark layer at the bottom are your operations and maintenance expenses, your O&M. These are things that you'll find in your annual budget. These are very well-behaved costs. They tend to escalate gently over the years. And then you have some debt service right now, and that is in the light gray here. And the solid line above all that is the rate revenue you're currently earning at your current rates. And you see that this line is above your O&M and your existing debt service. It's really the need to construct those projects that we just saw that is really driving the need for higher rates. And so in order to provide for those required projects, you're going to need annual rate increases of 4.5% per year for the 10-year forecast period. That's for water. On the sewer side, the numbers are a little bit bigger, and we're a little bit front-loaded here in the projects that you need. Total projects over the forecast period, $20.5 million. And here are some of those projects listed here. We do need a bond issuance. That's what this color in the year 2024 is all about. $1.1 million is what you need in that year, about $88,000 per year in annual debt service. Very similar story. O&M, existing debt service, all well below the line of your current rate revenue. But it's not enough to build all the projects that you need. And so we're calling for rate increases of 6.0% per year for the first 5 years, after which you should be good to go. So that's the revenue requirement. We had the output of that was a set of rate increases to be applied overall, and now we're going to look at them at the level of specific customer classes. And here's how we do that. We begin with a dollar amount that we need to raise in a particular year, and we take the costs involved in that total revenue requirement, and we allocate it to different functions, specifically these functions. In this case, this is water. We allocate it to the customer, the meters and services function, base demand, peak demand, and fire protection. Now, we sometimes get questions about what is the difference between base demand and peak demand, and why do you keep track of that, and why does that matter? It's a very important distinction. I want you to imagine for a minute that you have two water customers that are in a similar location, in a similar pressure zone. They use exactly the same amount of water each year. And let's just make up an easy number. Let's say these customers use 1 million gallons of water per year. They use the exact same amount. In fact, the only thing that's different about these two customers is one of them uses the same amount of water every day. And I actually did the math. It's about 2,700 gallons per day in level usage. So that's one customer uses that 1 million gallons in a level daily way. The other uses the same total amount, 1 million gallons, but they only use it 10 days a year. So they're using 100,000 gallons of water 10 times a year, and then they don't even turn the faucet on the other days. What's important about those is, for the second customer, I have to build infrastructure that can get them 100,000 gallons of water per day, even though they're not using it 355 days out of the year. That's a more expensive water system than the person who uses the same total amount of water, but very evenly spaced throughout the entire year. And so we do need, it is equitable, it is fair to make this distinction between base and peak demand, because peak demands really drive some of the key costs of maintaining a water system. And it just so happens that when one customer is using their peak demand, it usually happens that a whole bunch are experiencing their peak demand around the same time. And it really creates a burden on the utility that has to make sure everything is sized to meet those peak demands. Well, once we take all of those costs and we put them in these little functional buckets, we then look at each functional bucket individually and say, okay, how much of this bucket is used by the single family class? How much of this bucket is used by this class? How much of this bucket is used by other classes? And we begin to pour these costs into the individual customer classes, and we repeat that for all of the functions. And so you end up with these customer classes that have a revenue requirement that equals the total revenue requirement that you started with. For the water utility, once we make that allocation, you'll see that the vast majority of the cost is between base demand and peak demand, with peak demand being the greater one at about 54% of the total revenue requirement. And here are some, these are general attributes of the customer classes that we see in the water system. Your single family is always, almost always going to be your largest customer group. They like to water the lawn in summer, right? So there is some peaking factor for single family. Multifamily, you don't tend to see much peaking, because if they have a lot of landscaping to water, the landscaping is usually on an irrigation meter, and for irrigation for that particular class, you see a lot of peak usage. Commercial tends to be very diverse, a lot of different customers in that category, and so it's hard to make generalized statements about them. Industrial, very little peaking, because especially if you're using it in some kind of manufacturing process, it tends to be very steady usage. And so when we get the costs from the functions into these individual customer classes, we do it by means of certain metrics. For example, one of those little slices of cost was for customer related costs. Well, not surprisingly, the way we allocate that is by the number of accounts in each customer class. And likewise, for base demand, we allocate by the annual water use, and for peak demand, by the peak monthly use as opposed to the average use. The lower part of this table tells an interesting story, and if I'm not careful, I'm going to spend way too much time on this because it's interesting. But for example, the single family customer class has 83.5% of your accounts, but only 45% of your base demand and 50% of your peak demand, whereas your commercial class has only 13% of your customers, but 40.5% of your base demand and 31.8% of your peak demand. So a lot of water is going to these commercial customers. Okay, so here is where the cost allocation comes together, and this is probably the single most important slide for understanding a cost service analysis. So once we've gotten costs into these, I did it again. Once we've gotten costs into these functions, and then we've allocated them by customer class, which you have down here along the side, they will add up across to the total revenue requirement for that class. So this is what we should be earning for each customer class. In this column, this is what we're currently earning at the current rates with the current rate structure. And the difference between these two is this final percentage adjustment on the right side. This is the percentage adjustment to reach cost of service. So, for example, the total cost of service revenue requirement for single family residences is about $1.6 million. According to your current level of cost recovery, you're currently earning about $1.7 million, which means the appropriate adjustment, even taking into consideration we need 4.5% increase overall, is we need a decrease of 5.4% for that particular class. Now, for other classes, it's a different story. For industrial, we need a 35% increase. For irrigation, they need to double. That is the cost of service results for the water utility. So with all of these adjustments in place, you achieve the overall 4.5% increase in that particular year. 4.5% is an annual need, but these adjustments need only happen once to get everybody aligned correctly.
Can I ask a question?
Absolutely.
Okay. Just since we're on this table and it's so amazing. Your presentation is fantastic, by the way. Oh, very easy to understand. Very easy to understand, and I appreciate all your work. Irrigation. Can you explain what an irrigation customer is, or is that the additional use that a single family resident uses in the summer, or both?
So I'm gonna ask Wyatt to stand by on his customer data to give me some additional color commentary on this as needed. But the answer to the basic answer to your question is no. It is a separate customer class. It is a separate bill.
Okay. It's a separate meter.
Yes.
In many cases, you have commercial customers who have a meter for their commercial use, and then they'll have a separate meter to do, and irrigation is just landscaping, watering. Typically single family residences only have the one meter, and they do their outdoor summer irrigation using that meter. But for commercial and other non-residential classes, they often have both meters, and irrigation is just separated because its usage pattern is so different than typical commercial use.
So question for Bill, where are those? That one shocks me.
Yeah, I can add a little bit to that. So there's, for instance, some churches, you know, some other entities with large lawns, golf courses. And the reason why they would choose an irrigation account is because that's an account class that doesn't have a base charge, or we require all other accounts to pay all year long. The only irrigation are able to turn their billing off seasonally. So that's the incentive to have an irrigation account.
And an additional incentive is irrigation. There is no assumption on the sewer side that irrigation goes down the sewer.
That too.
All right. So now we're gonna do the same thing on the sewer side, but I'm not gonna go into the same level of detail because it all works the same way. We start with a revenue requirement that gets allocated into individual classes. The names are different. We have the customer, that one happens to be the same. You have flow, which is the volume of material going through the pipe. You have two different strength categories, BOD, this is biochemical oxygen demand. This is a measure of how you break down organic material. And TSS is total suspended solids, which is all about inorganic material. And we also have the function of sludge hauling, which is based upon some very specific data we got about the city's costs. We were able to get some very specific costs into that bucket. And then, like as before, we look at the individual customer classes and we allocate the costs from each function to each class. Total revenue requirement is largely based upon flow, about 58.5%. That is completely normal and typical. Customer makes up a very small slice, but that's also pretty normal. Flows and loads, or strength, to lump TSS and BOD together are the typical big cost items, and that is no different here. Here you have a similar explanation of kind of the typical characteristics of different sewer customer classes. What's the one that's really unique here is the sludge hauling class, and this is sludge that is hauled to the treatment facility from neighboring communities, and we try to get them to pay mainly for their direct costs, which includes the transportation element.
Doug, can I ask, is like multifamily in the single family category or somewhere else?
So why back me up on this, but multifamily would come under non-residential is my understanding. Why, can you confirm that?
Yeah, that's right.
So by non-residential, we mean non-single family. This is a similar breakdown that you saw on the water side. This is for sewer. This shows you the statistics by which the costs in each function are allocated to individual customer classes. Same story, you know, single family is 86% of the customers, but only 26% of the flow, 16 or 17% of the strength. The strength is here, man. Look at that. Non-residential, 14% of your customers, but over half of your flows and loads.
Quick question for Will. Are all the breweries must be in non-residential? Because they should, I would expect them to be dominating the industrial row.
Right. Except for Full Sail, which is in the industrial pretreatment. The same as Ryan Juice. So they're big enough that we actually test, like with beakers. They have to test their BOD and TSS. But all the medium size breweries are just commercial accounts. So that will be a part of this as well, is talking about differentiating strengths within that non-residential category.
So this is the single most important cost allocation table for sewer this time. So here you have all of the functions across the top, the classes on the left, the individual functional costs by class add up to a cost of service total revenue requirement here. What you are currently earning at current rates here. So in order to achieve an overall 6% increase, we need these rather large swings in the individual customer classes. So these range from a 58% decrease for single family up to a 329% increase for sludge hauling. So these are undeniably big increases, which raises an important issue that this is a good time to talk about. In both water and in sewer, you saw a negative number in the single family category, as in the equitable cost of service approach would be for those rates to go down. Well, we don't actually recommend that individual rates be lowered. What we typically recommend is a phase-in period where any customer class with a negative number is held constant, and those customer classes with a positive adjustment are brought up to speed as gently as possible over a multi-year period. So if we phased in these cost of service rates over a multi-year period, you would have single family paying a little bit more than its equitable share in a decreasing level, but you would have other categories, other customer classes stepping up their rates in a perhaps more controlled and gradual way. So that approach to phasing in rates, cost of service rates, has worked really well for our clients, and that's probably something that we would recommend that you consider. Actual decreases in rates is something that we try to avoid, because your costs don't behave that way. It's not like your costs are going down. It's just that we're trying to make this one-time adjustment. So as we begin now, I've kind of shown you what we have to show you tonight as far as cost of service. The next step for water and sewer is to begin to look at rate design. And the first step in rate design is understanding where you currently are in your rates. And these are your current rates. But an example of where we might go, for example, in water. Let's say you have a single family residence, and let's begin with the assumption that you're not going to do any phase in, that you're going to get everyone to their cost of service rates just all at once. And so we've broken down here, starting with your existing rate, in order to get that overall 4.5% increase, a single family base rate would have to increase $1.81. And the commodity charge per 1,000 gallons would have to increase 11 cents. But for the cost of service adjustment, which was negative, if you recall, the base rate would actually need to go down $4, the commodity charge down 25 cents. And the cumulative effect of the overall increase and the cost of service adjustment would lead you to a cost of service rate of a $38.06 base charge and a $2.35 commodity charge. Again, that's if you did this in one fell swoop. Now, we don't necessarily recommend doing it that way, but that's how the math would work. And we have a similar example down here for commercial, where not only do they need the 4.5% overall increase, but there is a cost of service adjustment on top of that, which would take a commercial customer with a 2-inch meter from $216 per month to about $230 a month. What a phase-in strategy would do for you is it would take away this customer from a reduced, it would not let their rate go down, but it would allow the commercial customer, their rate to come up a little more gently. That's the idea of a phase-in. So the next step in this process is to figure out what kind of phase-in schedule, if any, we want to implement for those cost of service shifts. And then we're going to go in and tackle the issue of rate design for water and sewer rates. And that's where we get into an issue that we haven't even talked about here, which is how do we allocate that between fixed and volumetric charges. And there's still stormwater that we need to look at. We have now gotten the data that we need to be able to charge based upon impervious surface area, and we're going to begin to put that study together for you in the next phase of our work. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
This is Megan Saunders. I'm wondering, with the multifamily being in non-residential for sewer, do they have, I mean, obviously it would be more flow. Do they have a different ratio of the BOD and TSS than single family? Or why are they lumped in there?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
If you want to go one slide over. Forward, yeah.
Is that right?
Yes. Okay. So multifamily is in the non-residential class.
Yes.
Obviously, or maybe that's not even this slide, but non-residential overall has a way bigger proportion of the biological oxygen demand and total suspended solids than single family. Would a multifamily, this might be the right one, but does multifamily result in more biological oxygen demand and total suspended solids than single family? Like, I mean, obviously for more flow, but
not generally.
Stay the same?
Yeah.
So, hey, Doug, could you show the existing rate structure just for a second?
That
one slide? Because it'll illustrate right now the current rates apply as you see here. We will be developing rates that have strength distinctions like you see here, that, and there could be more. The classifications could be different, but multifamily residential will undoubtedly be in the low category and will pay a rate based on their loadings, which are just as you said, just like single family residential, their loadings are similar, domestic strength. So they won't be punished by being in the non-residential class because they'll pay the lowest strength rate, if that makes sense. The reason we put them in there is because they vary dramatically in the amount of volume, water usage, which is how they're built. The meter sizes vary, so they actually behave more like, or they're easier to bill as if they were non-residential, but they'll be charged no more than a residential volume rate. I hope that made sense.
Yeah, I guess that's, I mean, and this is more the policy thing of, especially with the chart of non-residential was going to be increased, you know, 90% increase, and residential was going down. That I'd hate to see multifamily be punished for being lumped into a different group, even if their actual load on the sewer system is equivalent to other residential use.
Yeah, that's a really good point. The increase should be borne by the higher strength non-residential customers, but that's something we'll be paying close attention to.
Okay, thank you.
This is questions? Jessica. Yeah, thank you, Mayor. Would you ever do a phase-in with no increase for those that are currently paying too much, like the, basically instead of doing a 4.5% for single-family residential, would you hold it flat for a longer period of time?
Yes.
Yes.
This is Megan again. With the sewer charge, there's the increase for 5 years and then it stays flat for 5 years. Is maybe it's harder math, but is there value in having a lower amount over the 10 years where you kind of... So it's not, you know, it seems like a time equity issue potentially.
So if I understand your question, so we're, the slide that you saw, that the one I've got up here, has 6% per year for 5 years. Mm-hmm. And do I interpret your question to mean, gosh, why can't you just stretch that over 10 years?
Well, I wouldn't want to do 6% over 10 years, but can you?
Right.
Can you do a more gradual increase over 10 years instead of for five and then it's flat for five?
No. And this is the reason why. Because of how your CIP is loaded.
So maybe not without moving capital projects.
Exactly.
Because they're sort of front loaded, you have to get up that hill a little quicker in order to on the capital as it is scheduled.
So, and I don't know that this would be something we'd want to do, but it's not that you couldn't do more debt and then have, you know, future people pay off some of that to change the time frame of when people are paying more.
We can certainly look at that.
And I'm going to maybe rely on Will of if that's a good idea or not. But
yeah. We'll take that under advisement and look at what that would mean as far as loading us up with maybe an unsustainable amount of debt. But if that's an objective that council would like to achieve is more steady rate increases, we can definitely see how debt might be able to facilitate that and bring forward what the trade-offs are there.
And just to, if this helps at all, to clarify some of the math that goes into these rates, it can sometimes be tempting to think that a 1 year 10% rate increase gets you the same place as 5 years of 2% rate increases. but it doesn't work that way because when you raise your rates in the first year, that's revenue that you continue to get in year two, year three, and year four. And so there is a compounding effect. So when you stretch out rate increases, the end rate will always be higher, if that makes sense. Other things equal.
Other questions? Eric?
Oh, yeah, good.
Thank you, Mark. Forgive me for being sort of new to this whole municipal sewer charge situation, but I want to step back and just make sure I'm understanding the context. So we are setting rates because the city has basically a monopoly, and so we probably have some statutory direction to set rates equal to cost of service, and we're trying to do that through this analysis. Is that right?
Well, you don't have, and I'm glad you brought this up because this is something I should have mentioned. We go through a very careful, rigorous, scientific cost allocation analysis to maximize the equity between customer classes. But there's no law that says you have to set rates this way. So we go through the revenue requirement analysis to tell you what your overall rate increases need to be if you want to keep this thing in business. And then we do the cost of service analysis to help you understand what is the most fair way to allocate the cost of the utilities to your customer classes. But you're under no obligation to charge the cost of service rates. We believe you would be smart to do that, because not only is it equitable, but it also mitigates risk. If you have sudden changes in your customer base, it's more likely that the right amount of revenue is going to show up if each class is charged the appropriate amount for its burden on the utility. But there is no statutory requirement that you set rates in that way. The hurdle that you have to get over is you just can't be arbitrary and capricious. Okay. for similarly situated customers. If that makes sense.
Thank you. And what was motivating my question was I was thinking back to the big jump up in cost to the irrigation folks and the commercial or industrial folks on the water supply side, and I just wondered if we're doing this, if there's such a big jump up here, I wondered what happened in the past to get us off path. But what I'm hearing you say is maybe you bring your own formula to the table. So whatever was done previous was just the previous formula. This is a new formula. You're using your own discretion. You're not guided by some strict rule to match cost precisely. I guess I'm trying to figure out why the big change in those categories.
So if I may, the cost of service analysis, this allocation is an industry standard approach. We're applying the AWWA industry standard approach. We don't know what was done the last time a cost of service analysis was done, or if a cost of service analysis was done to set the rates previously. So what we often call these equity shifts when you see the pie change as much as it is here, and you saw it even more dramatically in wastewater. So it is more than our discretion or our formulas. This is the industry approach, and what we can't speak to is how it was done in the past.
And when was the last time we did this? Does anyone know?
Yeah, 2015, and it did not include a cost of service analysis. It was just revenue requirements. So we just said, how should the entire system go up and down? Basically, you see that 4.5% in the bottom right-hand corner? That's where the 2015 analysis stopped. So we are truing up to cost of service, and it was not done in 2015. I don't know when it was done prior to that either. But I can say, so there's two things that can be happening. One, it's been a while since we've trued up to actual cost of service. Two, the customer classes have changed over time. So while we've had big industrial users and breweries really flourish over time, that is a totally different type of demand on our system than maybe the Hood River of
10 and 20 years ago.
And do we know how many folks are on the irrigation category?
Not off the top of my head, but I could look it up for you pretty quick.
Thank you.
Eric, I don't remember this. 60 people.
60 accounts.
Accounts.
Yeah, sorry.
Okay. I don't remember, and maybe you can remember, Mark, but I don't remember this thorough of an analysis on the usage ever since I've been doing this anyway.
Yeah, but Kate and I were on council when in the 2014-15 one, but it was, you know, it had been flat for a long time before we were there, and it was, you know, capital improvement plan based, where they, you know, relooked at the CIP and said we're way behind and we need to both catch up and pay for the new CIP. But I certainly don't, you know, we had people just like you guys sitting across the table telling us how to make it flat forever, and obviously not. So I don't know what prevents the 10 years from now council asking that same question.
Well, I'd say this aspect of it was not a part. I can provide the 2015 analysis, and you can see this was not a part of the analysis. So the key is, on a regular basis, bringing in experts to do this analysis and continually tweaking and riding the ship, you know, on some sort of reasonable interval, 5-10 years, something like that.
Can I ask one more just clarifying question? The 4.5 or 6% annual increase, that does that include the cost of living, or that's in addition to a cost of living increase?
So that would include the effects of inflation. So 4.5, this is for water, and the 6% was for sewer. That reflects the effects of inflation in your costs, but this is not a cost. The 6% and the 4.5 themselves, these aren't cost of living adjustments. These are cost based increases because your costs are going up.
Right, but we wouldn't have to add on a, you know, 2.3 cost of living increase to whatever the 6% would add.
No.
Right.
Okay.
This is all in.
Yeah, Counselor, I think what you're referring to is when we set the rates in January, we just did the CPI adjustment because we weren't at a place where we had any of this data yet.
Now hold that thought for SDCs, because that is a great thing to do with SDCs.
So I could jump in here real quick. Mm-hmm. First of all, Doug and John, thank you so much for this presentation. It was a really nice presentation. I really appreciate it. Can we have a copy of it? Do we have a copy of it, Will?
We do. I'll forward it out.
That'd be great. And I guess another thought is that, since we're on the discussion of trying to be consistent and wondering what we did several years ago, obviously there's been a lot of data collected and compiled associated with this. Is there a plan to transfer that to the city as well? Do we have that, Will?
I'm sorry.
The data came from us. As far as all of FCS's spreadsheets, I'll let Doug.
Yeah, so Counselor, you own everything. So not only will you be getting the slides, you'll be getting a report, and you'll be getting the analysis spreadsheets, which include all the data provided by the city in one handy little place. And the reality is because we trade this information back and forth with staff, mostly Will, to validate all the inputs, you actually have multiple versions of this. So yes, you get it all.
That'd be great. I think that would help helping the future councils to look back and see what was done and understand why and how and everything. So thank you so much. Great presentation.
So I guess my question for you, Will, is we have the data for this. There'll be continued gathering of data for other things. And so do you need us just to nod our heads that going forward? Should we ask staff to bring us back a recommendation now that we have this data? Or how would you like to move forward?
Well, maybe I'll tell you how we're planning on moving forward and you let me know if we need to course correct. Is moving on to rate design I can completely concur with FCS's recommendation that instead of snapping into immediate equitable distribution, it's good to phase it in to be more gentle with all the rate classes so it's not so jarring just in 1 year. So that's what we're going to do unless I'd say there's any really strong objection to moving forward in that manner.
So I don't have any objection to that at all. Others?
I think that may be especially important given what's going on right now too and some of the financial difficulties that people are experiencing.
I will note, it's one of the last pieces of this project is to take a second look at our affordability programs and make sure they're helping the people that need to be helped. So that would be, we're doing the core revenue requirements and then we're looking at how can we target and assist people who are having, who have a inability to pay.
And I think that the phasing in of this is a great idea because the people that are irrigating might decide to put some more landscaping in that might not take quite so much irrigation. So that's a good reason to phase it in. Great. Anything else? If not, we'll move on to our next subject. Thank you so much for the presentation. That was fantastic. Really appreciate you spending the time. All right.
Thank you for your time tonight.
Yeah. Thank you. All right. Downtown Hood River Parking Study. Dustin, you're up.
All right. Thank you, Mayor. Please let me know if we have any AV difficulties. In short, this is a matter that was brought before council in January 13th and the 27th. It was born out of the parking study and some of the recommendations that came out of that. A number of them are operational in nature. Some of them had to do with providing future supply. And when discussing this matter with the council, a couple kind of narrow scope items came out in the interim. These were kind of some topics that looked at historic buildings, residential conversions, and fee in lieu until a larger supply question was taken up by the Urban Renewal Agency. So I prepped a short memo as a summary for your consideration. This is a matter that would be a legislative change in nature. And so prior to initiating this at Planning Commission, we wanted to get some guidance from council regarding some topics and matters that you would want Planning Commission to consider in a legislative amendment. So within this, the changes essentially and surround residential conversions of your historically listed structures. This is a finite list that ends up in the code. On structures that have historical significance. The fee in lieu change has been considered in there and follows some of the kind of the rationale regarding what you provide in return for fee in lieu today. And then it has an associated demand-based parking rate. This would be a rate change to reflect the actual parking demands that are generated from your 800,000 square foot plus minus downtown and projecting some forecasted rates that match up with the demand created by by those users. So included, you have a white paper that came from the parking study, and you have a little rationale and background from our parking consultant. We were able to work under the previous contract approved by council and do some of this extra work just for your consideration. So we're looking for feedback and questions. Again, any items that you would want Planning Commission to hear by way of their evidentiary hearing and some focused concerns or recommendations that you have as council.
Okay, great, Dustin. Thank you so much. So I just wanted to summarize just a little bit more from what Dustin said. So I think we're looking at three different things that are going to be that came out of the parking study that are going to go to the Planning Commission, going to go through the legislative process. Then it will be a recommendation that will come to council. It's not quasi-judicial, so we can discuss this with constituents if they call us. And the Planning Commission will go through all of this information, come up with recommendations, and then it will come back to us. But what we're doing tonight is saying, yes, we want Planning Commission to look at these three things. And if we have anything specific that we're concerned about, we have questions about that we'd like them to answer, that's what we're gonna come up with tonight. Am I correct, Dustin?
That is correct.
Okay, great. All right. So there was quite a bit of information in here that came from this parking study. And I've, since Mark and I were on the parking committee, you know, we've gone through this with a fine tooth comb numerous times. So pretty familiar with most of this information in here. So I don't know, do you have anything to add to what we have, Mark? And then I'll get other counselors' questions or comments.
I'll just say that all three of these things were supported by the subcommittee as a whole, that, you know, finding ways to facilitate housing in historic buildings, and we talked about that at council as well, finding a interim fair and equitable in lieu program that would be the same, you know, constant for commercial and residential. And then the third one is just being able to say what are the requirements for parking for different uses and equalizing that. So those are things that we talked about in depth. I'm super happy to see that Dustin and Rachel are bringing them to us at this point to get moving on some of this stuff.
Yeah, I agree, Mark. I think this is great that they're going to be able to start on this. And it is interim, so hopefully it won't be too complicated for them to get through this part of it because this is interim. But I think the base demand that came, that was brought forward by Rick Williams Consulting, you know, they did a huge analysis with input from staff on what that should be. And it's not a huge difference, but it is. It will make a difference to some people being able to put parking in and get done what they want to do. So they're basing that on actual use, so that, and which is actual use today. But we will be continuing to look at the rates of parking over time because we're going to continue to do that. And so this may change in the future, but that's what the rates are today. And I'm talking about this third one, demand-based parking rate. Questions, comments from others?
Do we want to like go through these one at a time, or I don't know where we want to start?
Well, we can if you want to. Let's do residential conversions within historic buildings.
I guess I'll start since I asked for that.
okay.
I don't know. So just more clarifying questions and then some policy things to follow. But Rick Williams, his proposal includes that everyone signs a waiver saying that there's, you know, that they're not going to get any parking. Is that, like, why would we need that if they're, is there some assumption that they would otherwise get access to parking in that scenario, or is it just to keep it super, super clear?
I think it's basically to keep it super, super clear, because what we have now kind of implies that they would receive something in a roundabout way. So I think he said you need to make it clear that they will not get anything for that, for the fee they'd be paying.
Okay. And then, so there's, you know, there's the list of downtown historic buildings was included in the packet. I assume not all of those actually have residential conversion ability. Do we have any sort of estimate on like how many buildings or potential units would fall under this? And it's fine if the answer is no.
I didn't put a number to them. This would be the maximum, but not all these buildings have a second floor. So my assumption is we'd probably have, my estimate is 15 of those. Realistic possibility for a second floor conversion.
Cool. Then I guess two policy things. I really want to keep historic buildings in downtown. Clearly parking is a real issue for that. I would, if we're going to do this, then definitely if we're going to kind of give them the you don't have to do parking benefit, it would be great to make sure that they do stay residential and don't become short-term rentals. And also, if at all possible, it'd be great to see them be available to, you know, actual folks in the community and not just be super high income, second, you know, home type residential. So I don't know if that's possible with deed restrictions or other requirements to qualify for this kind of program, or if that's something we can't legally do, or it'd be great to have that be looked at.
I don't think we can do that, but we could look into whether we can do it, but I don't think we can. We've said that the commercial zone can be short-term rentals and it's all C zone. There will be short-term rentals in the R zone within the next 3 years that will go away because they're short, you know, because we have they're grandfathered in for only a certain period of time. So I would imagine that some of these may become short-term rentals and people will replace those ones that are out in the residential zones with more downtown. But we could look into whether it's legal, but I don't think it would be.
So there's no way to say you can get a waiver on parking if you do a deed restriction to not have it be a short-term rental, but you have to install parking if you want to have full flexibility? Or something like, I don't know, something like that.
So there, maybe Justin's going to say this. I actually had read that in the, in Rick Williams' memo. It's the very top of page 15 of our packet where it says, street level conversions would not be eligible for the exemption, nor would transient or hotel users, which is consistent in the code that delineates commercial versus residential uses. So I was trying to ask Dustin that question, but my notes were sketchy. But so would that also mean, I guess, if people were doing the conversion of the historic building and saying that they're going to do short-term rentals, would they thus not be eligible for the waiver?
Mayor?
Yeah.
Right now we, with the licensure of short-term rentals, we check and confirm that they have parking available. So even that mandate is something, or that request to limit this to short term is something we could definitely look at within our within the legislative process. So it's consistent now. I don't see it as a as an insurmountable hurdle. If you wanted to limit, if the council's will was to limit to transient or non-transient uses, that would be something we would confirm was possible with legal through the legislative process. But I think we envision this as a long-term rental, just because we do confirm parking requirements. Even in the C zone still requires a short-term rental to confirm that it has parking available, even though it doesn't have the residency requirement. So the residency requirement is there's an exception there in the C zone, but we still prove up the parking mandates. So we definitely would see this as, we would not expect this to be some sort of backdoor policy to eliminate a short-term rental parking provision. Unless that was council's, you know, council certainly has the prerogative and purview. If it wanted to expand it to a short-term rental, it could do that.
So I have a question. For instance, the where the Naked Winery was, that building, if they wanted to turn that back into a hotel, they would still need all the parking. They couldn't get a waiver for no parking. Is that true?
So if they were to go to a hotel, a transient use, they would not be granted a waiver under the way that this is drafted right now, unless council wanted to change that. So if they had a multifamily.
But they could pay the fee in lieu.
Yes.
Okay. So that's how they would be able to do it, is just to pay the fee in lieu, and then they could do a short-term rental, any of these, not just the hotel, that building, but any.
That's where we would want to make sure that we, when it came to your short-term rental license of residential, we would be able to confirm whether we wanted to mandate the parking requirement because of that, or allow that fee in lieu for short-term rentals of residential. We would have that opportunity to decides that in the regulatory context.
Okay, so we could regulate it through the fee in lieu versus the residential conversion of a historic building. Those are two different things, and we would regulate it through the fee in lieu portion of this. Is that true?
You could. I think okay. you have options here on how you wish to proceed.
One point of clarification, I think, Dustin, can you confirm hotels are different than a licensed short-term rental, and payment in lieu does not get you out of short-term rental licensing requirements, which require parking?
Correct.
But a hotel is a allowed use with its own approval criteria.
Correct. It is not licensed in the same way as a short-term rental of a residential property. It carries a different, it's just a different standard. It's a commercial use. So it wouldn't be a conversion. You couldn't convert the upstairs to a hotel and call it a residential use. Upstairs of a, you know, you wouldn't be able to have a hotel conversion moonlight as a residential user.
Okay.
Unless you wanted to grant that to both of them.
Okay, so I think what Megan was asking for is definitely possible from what you said.
Yeah, we could have discriminating factors between those classes.
Okay. So Megan, you're saying you would like the Planning Commission to look at that possibility when they go through this?
I would, yes.
Okay.
And then the kind of the second one was, if there's any way we can either force or encourage that the residential use would be for, you know, middle income or low income folks versus high income. And that one I do acknowledge is potentially harder or not possible, but if that's something that can be looked at, it would be nice.
I guess I kind of see that as kind of one of the drawbacks of this the study, is it doesn't seem to like take into consideration all of those types of dynamics. You know, I mean, is it going to be, I see the word, you know, the term affordable housing in here. I mean, is it a realistic expectation for these folks to do all these upgrades? I mean, that's part of getting, you know, part of the thing with that's throughout this document is trying to reduce the cost of them actually converting this to a residential by reducing the cost. But then if we start layering all these other things on them, is that going to be fiscally feasible for them to develop it into an affordable housing unit? You know, that I don't know the answer to that question for sure. But I think it's something that should be considered going forward. And, you know, I guess it kind of gets back to, these are pretty big policy questions, I think. You know, is that really the intent of this, is to provide affordable housing for workers in downtown? I mean, that would be an admirable goal. I mean, I have no idea whether it's possible or not. So, I mean, I see all of these things in this document that I have these questions on. You know, on one hand, it's saying, it's like, well, we want to turn downtown into a more lively and vibrant place, continuing out on into the evening. But then again, if we start saying, well, we want it to be affordable housing, I mean, does that get to the same type of goal? And I'm just throwing these out there as questions that I don't know the answer to.
Jessica?
I was going to say, as one point of information, there is a historic building in the Dalles that was able to use the attainable housing loan fund that the Regional Solutions has available, and has converted a second story and above historic building into attainable. That's the 120% and below. And Rachel's pointed out that this particular loan fund, you know, after the units sell, which these are gonna be rented. But anyway, so that is something that just happened in our neighboring city. I am a little worried. I just think it's got to be expensive to rehab some of these historic buildings. So maybe they're not, you know, they all wouldn't be able to meet that attainable wage requirement. But I also want to say that I would like to see more residential happening downtown. And I see this as a way to encourage that. And so I am in support.
Okay, others on this residential conversion of historic buildings? That's the one we're on right now. Eric?
Sure, well, thank you, Mayor. I liked how this discussion has gone. I guess where I come out on this, maybe just start with where I'm at and then kind of think through it after that, is with respect to the historical buildings, those seem different to me because those buildings have been here so long, and those owners, the historic nature of the building, I think, is in itself a factor for why I would be open to considering waiver of the fee in lieu for those. That seems fundamentally different to me than new construction in downtown. So to me, the fee in lieu discussion waiver issue is different for an historical building, which we want to preserve and has, you know, its own set of considerations. It's different than fee in lieu for new construction. When we have a parking scarcity, I would be concerned about, I'd want to have a lot more discussion before I got comfortable with waiving fee in lieu for new construction. But to me, the gorilla in the room here is that C-zone exemption for the STRs. To pick up on what Megan was talking about in her concerns, I mean, we have like Millionaire Row there on West End of Oak with those new condos. And it seems like if we just open the floodgates for fee in lieu for all residential construction downtown without eliminating the C-zone exemption, what we're going to have are Millionaire Row, where we have these fancy condos, and it's everything that we're not looking for in terms of affordable housing. And so, to me, and if this is a legislative process, it seems like everything's open for consideration. So we might consider, and I'm not necessarily even advocating for it, I'm just saying if we're going to be considering options, one of the levers might be eliminating that C-zone exemption so that we're treating all residential locations similarly. You know, and I know Key Development's been nosing around town a bit. There's a Willamette Week article, September of 2016, where in the city of Portland, Key Development, under the auspices of affordable housing, built up the Yard building. And as it turns out, the top couple floors of that building are being, or at least according to the Willamette Week, were being leased out. And so something like that, I would just be concerned about coming to Hood River, where we have the rest of the town on a clampdown for STR, but then potentially having a boom within the town with no parking to the disadvantage of all of our downtown businesses and the advantage of the Millionaire Row folks. So I see the C-zone exemption as being part of the discussion going forward.
Mark?
So I think a couple things. One is we do have these STR rules that Will and Dustin talked about that already prevent, mean that they have to provide parking. So, and B, we're talking about historic buildings in this thing here. So it's not new construction, and since none of these buildings have parking on site, it effectively is ruled out for STR as it is right now. To me, any kind of housing is needed housing. So even if we don't get the same affordability mix in the downtown core that we get somewhere else, maybe it reduces, you know, it increases the, we've taken up some of the balloon for one housing type, and it opens things up on, you know, in other places for a different housing type. So I'm not personally very worried about affordability. If like Jessica said, the developers can take advantage of things that incent them to do affordable stuff, I think that that's grand, and that'd be great. But I hate to, you know, we want housing in these historic buildings. The more rules we put on it, the more we're going to get what we've got. So that's that. And then the last thing for me, and it actually sort of counter argues what I just said, is that the proposal is they don't get any special benefits for parking. They're on, you know, they're on their own. They can, you know, they can find a private place. They can wait in line for the city lots. They can plug meters and stuff. But I think we should talk about whether it's a little bit more strict with respect to parking, that if they're going to want parking for their customers, their clients, that they would have to do off, not in city parking. A, they could market it to people that ride bikes only, and that's fine. Or B, they would have to talk to the Elks and other private lot owners to provide parking if they needed to do that to sell the property or move the property. Does that make sense?
Any more discussion on, I think we kind of went off a little bit of residential conversion of historic buildings. We've kind of got into the fee in lieu a little bit there. But is there any more on the historic buildings? Okay.
I would concur. I really think it's important to preserve our historic buildings. So I think that should be a really important consideration and discussion. And I'm not exactly sure what's the best thing to get at that. But I concur that that's something that we want to retain in our downtown.
Yeah, I agree. And if those buildings can't be used or aren't being used, some of them are being very underutilized, and they could be used for residential, but the parking is the issue, then it'd be great to take that barrier
away. All right, let's go on to the fee in lieu. So we've had this fee in lieu. Do you want to go ahead and talk about fee in lieu specifically just a little bit, Dustin, about how it's not working?
Yeah, so in one of the themes of that seemingly of consensus that we have is that the fee in lieu structure was not as created in, you know, 14 years ago, has not been successful in attracting or being an incentive to development, especially in the way of residential, seeing really no takers. The market has pretty much rejected the opportunity to spend tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars when we don't have anything in provided in return. So our fee in lieu is structured to where it essentially was to pay for a what was going to be a structured parking space in those dollars. Yet there is no structured parking space available for those who pay that. So it's essentially a payment with no return, and that has not necessarily been attractive to those folks who are looking to develop under that scenario. So what we looked at is as an interim solution, fee in lieu was to be, there's an interim approach saying this is what's provided for the funds, and those funds would go into the operation and management of the system that kind of came out in the 31 or the 30 strategies that we saw in the parking study, until such a time where fee in lieu could be built into a larger capital program that involved urban renewal, that involved payment of other fees and the funding cocktail to look at a future long-term supply. So rather than try to jump to the long-term supply question and calculate a fee in lieu based on numbers that we don't have, it would be a short-term fee in lieu, acknowledging that you get really only the entitlement opportunity. You don't get any special privilege as far as parking spaces. There's really little in return other than investment in the overall system, until such a time that the parking supply question, be it a garage, be it a surface lot, be it a transportation or transit investment were developed, then a longer term fee in lieu based upon a capital program would be developed. So this is a short term response that equalizes fee in lieu for residential and commercial. It also bases the fee in lieu numbers around a revised parking rate. So rather than a fee in lieu calculation based on something that doesn't relate to the actual amount of parking that's needed, it kind of reconciles that code conflict, brings the fee in lieu into line into the number of spaces that that a particular user would need to generate. And that really kind of shows up on the before and after, shows up on your packets on page 14 from Rick Williams.
So this might just be a language thing, but page 20 and 21 is kind of talking about the interim approach, and it's suspend the current fee in lieu option within the code, and then, you know, revise parking minimums and revise the fee in lieu. By suspending the code, it just means like stop what we're currently doing and replace it with this other thing, not that like we're suspending fee in lieu as an option.
Right. It's stopping the status quo and replacing it with an alternate.
Okay, but like we would presumably do that like instantaneously if one goes out, the other one comes in, not that there's some period where we don't have anything.
Right, I believe they would be harmonized.
Okay.
Tim?
So how was the $3,000 per space? Do you know how that was come up, how you came up with that? I'm just curious.
So what the Rick looked at his Oregon users and blended a rate that had to do with those communities that were given no entitlements as a result of that. So something that was relatively low. That's really where it came from. It did increase the rate on which a commercial would pay. But it's really has to do with a lower tier of users that collect a fee in lieu and really develop nothing or return very little other than the entitlement. So you don't get a parking pass, you don't get a space, you get a right to develop. And so that low number, that 3,000 number, is based on that. And built in a little bit into kind of the cost of the overall parking operation philosophy.
And I remember that there were some numbers that other places had used previously, and they basically put a moratorium on building, which is what ours has. The residential number that we have now is basically put a moratorium on it. And so I think they kind of looked at that and said, well, if you have it X dollars high, that is in fact a moratorium. And so they tried to get a number that people actually would still pay, that would put some money into, you know, for instance, helping to pay for cat transportation or putting in more bicycle corrals or something like that, something that helped with the transportation system in general. Into that bucket, but not so high that it's going to put a moratorium on building.
I'm trying to recall what it costs to actually build a parking space. Do you recall, Dustin?
Surface or structure?
Just the surface.
Surface space, estimated $8,000. That's not a prevailing wage. That's kind of but that's a general philosophy. $8,000 to $10,000.
And so that really is kind of the stated policy, though, Kate, is that it would just go, it's just for, like, it's not intended to provide parking per se.
Exactly.
Yeah. So it's exactly. More to, maybe that's something that should be considered about, you know, what, if we're going to retain that in the interim, what would be the specific uses of establishing that fund? Would it be to promote, you know, bikeable and walkable transportation?
I think that that within the legislation, we could state that it's going to go towards, you know, the parking situation downtown, so to speak, mm-hmm. Whatever that is. I mean, we could have something that would designate where that money would go, and it could be used for numerous different things that have to do with parking and alleviating congestion. Other questions on this one? All right.
Or Madam Mayor?
Oh, go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, I don't really have a question. I'll just highlight the difference I see between historic building and new construction. And I am worried about the possibility of a wave of new construction in downtown, whether it's Key Development or anyone else, displacing the decades of investment of our our downtown business owners. And whether good or bad, intended or unintended, the fee in lieu has functioned to at least allow the status quo so that downtown businesses can have parking. I keep a really open mind about this. I'm just concerned and want to make sure whatever we do here makes it better, not worse. And I'll just be, you know, it's good to have the Planning Commission think through that so that we have their best work in the best interest of the community.
And if I could just follow up on that real quick, Kate, because I think in Eric's statement there was kind of a policy that I think is important is that, you know, really is what we're trying to do is to try to, are we doing it for the benefit of the downtown businesses? Is that really the intent? And I think that maybe could help steer some of the decisions that the Planning Commission has to make. I mean, is that really the intent? Because it seems like an admirable goal to me.
Sorry, Gabe. Yeah, go ahead, Mark. You can probably answer that. I was going to make a comment on that, but go ahead.
Well, it's effectively a moratorium. So if it's a policy issue, we want to stop development in downtown, then we've shown that our existing in lieu is a beautiful way to stop development. I'm not in favor of using, you know, the in lieu to stop development. I think we have a lot of other rules, I'd like to see what clever local solutions we come up with when that isn't a stopper. So
I kind of go back to regarding the businesses downtown. So the first use of the on-street parking should be for their customers. I mean, that is the stated goal of the parking study. It shouldn't be for employees. It shouldn't be for residences. It should be for paying customers, so to speak. Whether they're local customers or they're visitors, it's for paying customers. And so that is the goal of the parking study, is to make sure that paying customers always have a place to park, and it's only full by 85%. Once it gets fuller than that, we have to go to doing more things. And we know that one of those more things is finding more capacity. And finding more capacity is more off-street parking of some sort, whether it's structured or surface. So this is just an interim way to get more people to build more residences downtown so that they can have more customers, more year-round customers that can access their businesses. So I don't see it as something that's going to, I think it's going to enhance businesses personally, but we have to be very cognizant of keeping track of what the parking is like downtown. And that's what, you know, this study that we just did, this big long study and all this time and work we did on it, and continuing to look at how many people are parking downtown on a regular basis. And we know we're going to need more capacity. We absolutely know that, but we don't have it figured out quite yet. So this is a way to get more people downtown to spend more money. So that's how I'm looking at it. Jessica?
I'll just add a couple thoughts. One is that one question I have is that it's going for residential, it would be such a significant drop. I wonder if we would end up seeing a glut of residential permits while we ponder what the better rate is. You know, if they think, we got to get our application in while it's only $3,000. I don't know. It would be interesting to see what happens. And I also recognize that we're saying that basically the market, we are asking that the market to serve, to dictate how they meet their parking needs. And what the answer could be is, well, we tried this and we actually really still need you to build a parking garage, city. And so what if I, you know, private residential developer gave you $100,000 towards your parking garage and then I get, you know, 5 dedicated spaces. At that point, we might decide that, yeah, that's going to be what we all need. Those are my rambly thoughts.
Yeah, I think we did talk about some of those, Jessica, at our parking study, that it needs to be a partnership, whether it be a local improvement district along with urban renewal money, along with whatever else, grants, loans. So it's going to be a partnership of a lot of different things to be able to build a structure. One of the things that Rick Williams did recommend, though, that when we do this, when we get more capacity, is that we make sure that we don't only have residential in there. and that they don't have, they have a space, but it might not necessarily be number five all the time. We just make sure that there are enough spaces in there so they can park somewhere. So that was his recommendation, because maybe they only park there on the weekends, or maybe they only park there in the evenings. And so somebody else can use that space during the day, somebody that might be shopping downtown. He said, you need to share the spaces so that they aren't empty. Additional comments or questions? Okay, I don't see any. And the demand-based parking rate, does everyone kind of understand what that is? It basically just, Rick Williams did all the calibrations with the help of staff, giving him the information about the square footage of usage that is downtown, and then he counted the cars numerous times to see how many we really need. And so we're requiring 1.5 units for each residential, but they're recommending 1.25. And then for commercial, right now we say we need one per employee, and what we're actually using is 1.5 per 1,000 rentable square feet. So it's just truing up what we're actually using with, instead of, you know, kind of more of an arbitrary number that we're using right now. And that's what this demand-based parking rate is just to true it up with what we're doing. Okay. Do you guys need a motion to move it over to, I think we've given you a bunch of comments and things we'd kind of like them to look at a bit here. Do you need a motion on this or not?
Thank you, Mayor. Your comments and input is really, that's the guidance to Planning Commission, that those were the things we were looking for. So as we return with the legislative matter, our discussion and the deliberation should have some of those components included in it based on what we have. So that when you hear it again, you'll hear some feedback to address some of those issues that you have. So thank you. That's all we needed.
So Dustin, is the Planning Commission, have they been meeting remotely like we have or not?
No, I'm going to have our first Planning Commission meeting May 18th. That'll be our first remote meeting. Since it was really on non our non-required meetings were discontinued. We're getting to the point where we have some quasi-judicial matters to come back up, and we're kind of regrouping. But I anticipate a format similar to this in the Zoom world, where we will meet on the 18th for Planning Commission to relaunch these.
Thank you.
Thanks. Okay, I think we are close to 9 o'clock, so let's take a small break here because we still have Parks Master Plan, and then a few things on the consent agenda. So let's take 5 minutes. Thanks.
So the room that I moved to, it ends up that the ceiling light is like broken, and I don't know when that happened. So as it got dark, I said, son of a biscuit, I have to go find another room. So this one isn't much better.
I've been thinking you look like you're in Star Wars in that room, though. So that's fun.
In this one?
Uh-huh.
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay.
And Jonathan, are you on? Do we need to relaunch things, or are we recording, Jonathan?
We're still live and going.
And Mark and Marcy, you guys get the award again for...
I'm back, but I'm going to eat something, okay?
I am really missing our comfy chairs at the City Hall, by the way.
How are we going to do snacks on Wednesday? I don't know.
I was wondering if you're going to drop some off at my house, Mark.
Yeah, new challenge for Mark.
Okay, I'm just checking. Gladys, are you there? Okay, I think we have everyone. Parks Master Plan, Jennifer.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. Tonight, we're going to talk about the Parks Master Plan, and you'll recall that you spent two work sessions discussing the master plan last summer. And you also appointed three counselors, Zan Miller, Saunders, and Haney, to serve on a multi-jurisdictional subcommittee to work on the draft and to convey the city's recommendations on that draft. They participated in the subcommittee meetings. There were four meetings last fall, and the recommendations of that group and of the city were sent to the consultant who's been working on the draft, and we received a revised draft in late March that does address many of the requests that the city had for revisions, including the addition of an executive summary. The vision statement reflects your input. The revised goals, policies, and strategies reflect the city's input. There's a simplification of the park classifications, in part as a result of your input. The recommended level of service for park standards includes both a walkshed standard and an acres per capita, which was a request of the city. The walkshed maps now indicate walkshed areas for schools, which were not previously included in the maps. And the proposed park acquisition areas and proposed trails align with the city's work on the West Side Area Concept Plan report. And the capital improvements plan in the master plan has been significantly revamped to be a capital projects list that includes just larger projects, a general prioritization of those projects, and some general cost estimates. Your subcommittee, Councilors Zan Miller, Saunders, and Haney, along with staff, has reviewed the draft, revised draft, and have several recommendations for some additional revisions before we have a final document to potentially adopt by reference. Just briefly, the cover sheet and attachment summary have some explanation of these, but just briefly, the recommendations include adding some flexibility to the level of service standard in the plan. There's a thought that we might be able to meet the service standard by adding more numerous smaller parks than the 2 to 3 acre neighborhood parks that are identified. In some cases, depending on what the acquisition opportunities are, and there's a desire for, of the subcommittee to have just some flexibility on that. And to potentially add a level of service goal for trails to be, there be trails or some kind of greenway located within a quarter mile walk of residences. Some of the recommendations relating to the parks classification and inventory, you'll see in the plan that the inventory is currently organized by operator or manager, and the subcommittee felt it would be important to reorganize that to have the inventory by ownership that would better reflect this city's park lands and would also allow for the city to update its park inventory in the comp plan in a way that's consistent with the park's master plan if it was organized by ownership. As I kind of alluded to a minute ago, the recommended sizes for different park classifications are larger than what we typically see our parks today. So there was there's a recommendation from the subcommittee members to add some flexibility on that or to adjust those park range sizes. For example, the neighborhood parks are recommended to be 2 to 3 acres, but we have some neighborhood parks that are quite a bit smaller than that. So the subcommittee has some recommendations for adding some flexibility on that as well, particularly referring to the parks in the urban growth boundary. That might not be the case in other areas of the county. The subcommittee members also have some recommendations for adding clarifications to the roles. This was something we spent some time talking about last summer. There are three roles identified in the park master plan: a lead, a partner, and an advocate. And there's a little bit of confusion when there's more than one lead entity identified. So there's a suggestion that where there is more than one lead identified, or a co-lead, if you will, that the plan articulate that role is generally relating to the assets owned by that entity. In other words, the city would be a lead for city-owned facilities. And the Parks District might also be a lead in that particular action, but they would be taking a lead on their facilities. For the advocate role.
Jennifer.
Yes.
If it had a lead, but nobody owns it yet, it's a suggested purchase. How would you determine who was the lead on that?
Some of those would be worked out on a case-by-case basis. I would imagine acquisition might be one of those items, and we might be looking at land somewhere on the west side, for example, to acquire. And I think that there's a general understanding between, for example, the city and the Parks District to partner as much as possible on some of those larger ticket items so that we can realize those goals. But the specifics of that are not identified in this plan. It leaves open the possibility for those arrangements.
Okay.
The advocacy role, there there are some that may beg questions of the council of whether the council wants to be an advocate for a particular action by another entity. We thought it might be helpful to include some clarification that the advocacy actions or the resources used for advocating something would be determined on a case-by-case basis. That allows for some generalizations in the plan that the details of which could be worked out on a case-by-case basis in the future. In addition, we had several, identified several miscellaneous corrections and clarifications that I've identified in your packet, and I won't go into those in any detail, but on any of these, I'd be happy to answer questions. You have a couple options to proceed with the recommendations as outlined here. The subcommittee felt like these were issues that should be brought to your attention before they took them back to the multi-jurisdictional subcommittee. There's not a scheduled meeting date yet for that multi-jurisdictional subcommittee, but it's my understanding that that group will meet again sometime in the relatively near future to weigh in on this revised draft. So our suggestion is that you instruct your fellow counselors who have been working on this subcommittee to take these recommendations to the larger group. And this is also an opportunity for any questions or additional input you have for me.
Great. Thank you, subcommittee members, for all your time on this and looking through this draft and making these additional recommendations and bringing them back to us. That was a ton of work you guys did. So thank you again for spending all that time. So I don't know if Megan and Mark and Eric want to give us some additional information on these, or if, you know, we just want to go with questions from the other members. Megan, looks like you've got your hand up. You want to just give us an overview?
Well, I actually, so I think Jennifer did a great overview of everything. I did just, and this was my read of our conversation, but clarifying with the flexibility and the level of service about smaller parks instead of the 2 to 3. I don't see that as a level of service thing, because it's not changing, you know, the acres per thousand or that we're aiming for within a half mile, but it's more the implementation, kind of what we talked about on the west side of, you know, yes, we definitely want 3 anchor community parks in the identified locations, but we also potentially want some smaller things to break it up, so we're not just saying you get 3 large things and then nothing, because that may not actually be both possible with what land is available, and also may not be the best, you know, use of green space for local neighborhoods. So I think that's more the implementation potential capital plan versus it's a change in the level of service proposed, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And if Mark and Eric agree, I guess.
I think the question is like where, you know, is it in the level of service thing? I think that the way Jennifer put it here is pretty clear what our intent was. And we can go to the bigger subcommittee and say, you know, how do we maintain the flexibility in this intent? Is it, you know, if it's not the level of service table, it's somewhere else. And we'll make sure that it fits in a logical place. But so I agree with Megan and I agree with Jennifer, both. So that's good. Just since I have the mic, the only thing I'll add is, Jennifer has some active commenters on our subcommittee, and she's been professional throughout and collecting those things and putting together something in a logical way to hand off to Mark and Marcy and that group. So I appreciate your work on this. It's way beyond what we've been doing, which is throwing rocks. So that's good. So
I'll second that. Thank you, Jennifer. You've been really amazing.
Eric, do you have anything?
Sure.
Yes, Jennifer has been wonderful. We did spend quite, I think it was the last week, we spent 3 hours going through this again, and in particular focusing on nuanced choices between partner versus advocate. And I guess I would highlight that by also saying that, remember, this is an aspirational document. So we're not, even by its own terms, were we to adopt this, this is just what we're shooting for. The city is reserving the full right to do whatever it ultimately wants to do, but this is an aspirational document. We're introducing level of service flexibility to pick up the walk shed as well as parks under more of a traditional acres per population. There were some details surrounding the inventory that were fixing. There was just some, I don't know if there were mistakes, but clarifications that we all agreed should be made. So we've worked through that as well. And lastly, we're trying to recommend that the parks folks kind of shorten and simplify to keep it lean and digestible.
Yes. This is better than it was, but the leaner, the better.
Right.
Others, comments on the recommendations? I've got a couple things. So on the recommendations under level of service for the trails, I'm okay actually, because I walk to a trail, to the Indian Creek Trail, and I think it's about a third of a mile till I get to the trail. I think it could be a little bit further than a quarter of a mile. It could be up to a third of a mile to get to a trail. It's just a nuance, but I would say it could be a little bit further than, because it seems totally reasonable to make it a little bit further away. So that's just my comment on that one. I've got a couple more things. The inventory list, I could take it or leave it, whether it's, by city owns this and parks owns that. I mean, we can figure out who owns what. So I don't think that's necessarily needed, but, might be nice. Going to revise neighborhood and community parks recommended size ranges. So you've got different numbers here. I think you might be able to say 0.7 to 3 acres for a neighborhood, but you could also say preferring approximately 2 acres. So it's kind of like we'd like it to be a little bit bigger, but if it can't be, it's okay. If you just, and it's the same thing for the 2 to 10 acres, preferring closer, to 10 acres or something like that. But it still leaves the flexibility in there, but saying you'd like to make it bigger if it could be. Let's see here. I like the role refinements. I really like that. I think that's definitely needed in there. And then I specifically was surprised that the port is hardly mentioned in here at all. So I wanted to see if you guys could give me some input about that, because they're in here in some places, but other places they're completely left out. Like change it to say that a guiding recreation plan for Hood River Parks and Recreation District, City of Hood River and Hood River County. And I know one of the surveys said that we need more river access. And I just don't see hardly anything in here. So did they not come to meetings, or why does it seem like they're kind of left out?
I mean, I think they attended meetings. I would say all of our edits have been really focused on city specific stuff, and we haven't touched, if the county or the port should be a lead or a partner or an advocate on things or how they interact with the plan. Because that's not really our decision.
Okay.
But they've been engaged.
Okay. I just wondered, because, it kind of states city, county, and parks and rec, and it's like
court's not, and it's such a big part of the recreation mix. So that's why it just seemed odd.
I'll just add one thing. In particular, I think you're referring to the sentence that sums up the purpose of the plan. And I think you raise a good point. It's the sentence that leads off the executive summary of the plan, and it's in another prominent place in the plan, about it referring to being the guiding recreation plan for those entities. And I think it is worth discussing where the port should be added to that list of entities. They were active in the meetings.
Okay. That's all I had on these. Others, do you have anything?
So I have a question about, sorry, Gladys, if you want to go ahead. Do you want to go ahead? Okay. I have a question about the inventory and what the criteria were for being included in the inventory of parks and facilities.
I don't recall there being any specific criteria. I think that there's an inventory included in the 2002 master plan that was adopted by Parks and Recreation District, and I think that's what they worked from. And then there may have been additions to that inventory. But I'm not aware that there were specific criteria used to develop.
I'm just wondering, because I see the there's Morrison Park North, undeveloped open space of 5.76 acres. Was that? I'm just kind of wondering if that was in the original inventory or not. Do you recall, anybody?
I looked into that a little bit this afternoon, Councillor Cunahan, and that is not included in the city's inventory in our comp plan. It was included in the Parks District 2012 master plan. I have not been able to identify that it's included on any official inventory of the city's. So I think that whereas the southern portion that is used for disc golf is included in the city's comprehensive plan inventory. So I think there's an option there, and the two parcels north of I-84, the city is not under any obligation to include those in the inventory.
Thanks for the clarification.
Gladys?
Yeah, so this is the first time that I'm seeing this. So overall, it looks beautiful. Thank you for everyone's time and commitment to this. But I feel it as I was reading it, it's not very specific to like who the audience is or who the end utilizer will be. And I mean, in terms of, I don't see anything about like multi-generational parks, you know, for example, that park up in Odell, I can't think of what it's called. One of the newer parks, but you know, like has exercise equipment where, you know, maybe grandparents are going and parents and little kids are riding bikes around the trail. So it makes me feel like I can bring my parents along or grandparents along. I didn't see terms like that. I also didn't see anything in regards to language. And I'm wondering, I imagine that this came up in the conversations, but this is just a very broad overview. Those are my comments.
Thank you, Councillor Rivera. I think those are good comments, and the Parks District staff is listening to this conversation, so we will share those comments with them. Just for your background, the effort to create the multi-jurisdictional master plan has been led by the Parks District. The city helped fund the grant that was obtained to fund the project. They've been working more directly with the consultant. So I think these are good comments that we will share with us, with the Park District staff.
I would just add, Gladys, it's really a 140-page document with a whole other appendix thing. And within that, there's sections talking about, you know, the health benefits of parks and aging. And the subpart that was in our packet today isn't the whole document. And I'm sure we can get you this draft if you want to look at it.
Now that I'm trying to find it, I can't, oh wait, right here. Where it goes into like administration and it says that it's gonna promote active and ongoing participation by diverse community members. Like if maybe that could be defined on what, you know, who those community members are. Is it based on, you know, age, socioeconomic status, you know, things like that.
I'll just jump next and say that I appreciate all the work from the counselors on the subcommittee and from Jennifer. It's clear, and also from the Parks and Rec District staff here, it's clear there's been a lot of more work since the last time we saw it. I feel like my comments from the last time were heard, and I didn't really have more to add right now. But thank you for everybody.
Thanks. I was just looking at page number. It's one of the maps, I think it's the second map, and it has areas where there's some yellow. They look like little stars or flowers or something on it. And those are the areas where there would be community park or neighborhood park, I believe. And I do see this one that's kind of close to Westside Elementary. And I assume that possibly that was put there because that Blackman Skakel property is close to that. But if there was another piece of property that might be a little bit closer in that area that's white, which doesn't have any color whatsoever, I would assume that if a large piece of property came available in that area, that this star could be moved over a little bit. These are just general vicinity stars, correct?
Correct. These are general acquisition target areas. Okay. And so, yes, you're correct. And it's page 60 in the packet in the lower right-hand corner. Our page numbers that are packet.
Oh, I see it. 60. Yeah, I can see it. Small. Okay. Additional comments on this?
Right. Mayor, if I could just briefly respond to Tim's question about the inventories. I think the way the subcommittee approached it was from a desire to just make sure, above all, that the inventories are accurate. I mean, the deeds are ultimately going to say who owns what, but this will, you know, by design, be an important document for the management of parks for the next decade. So we want, above all, the inventory to be accurate. And if you actually read it carefully, perhaps because there's been edits and revisions along the way, it's actually ambiguous as to whether is this an inventory of parks as managed, or is it an inventory as parks as owned? And speaking with staff, we thought it might be better to just treat it like a traditional inventory. Let's just get this right factually and have it be an inventory by who owns what rather than who manages what, because that's just more nuanced. But I think above all, Tim, the goal is just to make sure the inventory is factually accurate.
Okay. Do you need anything else from us, Jennifer, or the subcommittee? No?
If everybody feels comfortable, I think your subcommittee of counselors and staff is ready to go.
Great. Fantastic. Thank you so much. Appreciate it. All right, we are going to adjourn the work session. And we will open the regular council meeting. Do we have any agenda additions or corrections?
We do not, Mayor.
Okay, we have a consent agenda with, looks like two
OLCC permits on it. Do you have any questions on those?
Can I make a disclosure, Madam Mayor?
Sure.
Okay, so these little music things are getting away occasionally, but I Kickstand is a music venue, and I may have made $50 to $100 over the last couple of years playing there. You know, they mostly pay in hamburger, but I wanted to just disclose that in the bounds of being cautious. I don't think that will impact my impartiality in approving their liquor license, but I have worked there.
Okay. Thank you for your disclosure.
Do we know which building the 409 Oak is? Is it the?
I think it's Sparkling Creations.
Is that the Crystal Place?
Yeah. Should I move that we accept the consent agenda?
I will second.
We have a motion from Megan and a second from Jessica to approve the consent agenda. Additional discussion? Okay. So I'm going to do a roll call for the vote on this. That's what we've been instructed to do for these. So, Councillor Mehta?
Aye.
Councillor Zan Miller?
Yes.
Councillor Cunahan?
Aye.
Councillor Haney?
I made my disclosure. I didn't hear any objections, so, and I feel like I can be an impartial, so I will vote aye.
Councillor Rivera?
Aye.
And Councillor Saunders?
Yes.
And Chair votes aye. All right, we've approved the consent agenda. Regular business items. Oregon Department of Transportation increased to the city's share of preliminary engineering for Cascade and Rand.
You did that on purpose.
You're going to go down in Zoom history for this, Kate.
I agree with her.
Oh. Yeah, give us the bad news, Wade.
Yeah, I think you've probably read the bad news. It's more or less an amendment to the cost portion of the IGA we entered into with ODOT in 2017, July. In October 2017, the city paid the $56,000 deposit for their portion of preliminary engineering, which was estimated at about $550,000 then, and now it's almost doubled. In the IGA, ODOT agreed to participate up to $750,000. That was the estimate they had to put in a pedestrian crossing near the Walmart entrance, and they agreed to put that money towards the signal instead. DIG puts everything else on the city. So the increase in the design portion is $458,000, I think, bringing the city share up to $514,000, I believe. That phase is drawing to a close. We'll be moving into the right-of-way phase in probably July, and there's another significant increase in the estimate there. I think they were just way too low in 2017, $400,000. This is hopefully a worst case scenario for the right-of-way funding. We have some redesign that's been done. It significantly and reduces the impact to Walmart and to Columbia State Bank. So hopeful we'll see some savings there. And in the construction side, I should have a new estimate for construction by probably late next month or maybe June. So So the recommendation, I guess, is to increase our cost share by quite a bit.
So Wade, the fiscal impact, this $1,321,785, that's the two numbers together, is that right?
Yes.
Yeah, and just a clarification, Mayor, that money was already in the budget. We will have another conversation once we get the construction estimates. That's really where we're going to see, I'm afraid, Wade and I are afraid, that's where we're going to see the real impact of the cost increases. Design, preliminary design, one thing, this was in the budget, but when we get to construction, it's going to be, flowers.
We'll see that estimate soon, but it will be just an estimate.
But this is this cost of the $1,300,000 does include the right of way.
It does.
Which we were kind of like knowing it was going to be higher because of the design, but maybe it won't be quite as high as we were hoping for those two other entities to offset that just a little bit.
Hopefully,
but yes. It won't offset. This number is the, you like you said, worst case scenario. You're hoping for the whole thing, for that portion of it.
They tell me that they budget the right of way for worst case.
Okay.
So
more questions?
I mean, given this cost and or I guess potentially astronomical implementation costs, how much control do we have over controlling costs and being able to do something there without completely blowing our entire road fund?
I think the biggest thing we've done is to decrease the size of the north leg. It's probably about 50 feet wide now, and it was designed originally to be over 80 feet wide, and we've reduced it back to essentially the size it is now, just being realigned. I think realistically, that's the biggest impact that we'll be able to have on those numbers.
I mean, you guys have heard me harp on this before, but basically we're at the mercy of the state to just be on the hook for whatever they say we are on the hook for.
That's the agreement, yeah.
Or we don't get it. I mean, that's the other...
Right. Well, so I'll just harp on the same thing of I really don't like this and it's completely unacceptable, but we also need to do it. So,
Mark?
So, I mean, this one is so upsetting. Isn't the IGA null and void as soon as they change the rules? I mean, what if we just say, no, it's on you guys that we have an unsafe situation and you're trying to ding us for $3 million? First of all, Wade, I know you're doing a great job. You're being a pro. You're working. I have nothing bad to say about our staff. I just feel that, and I have no faith that they're not going to do it to us again and put us over another barrel. And next time they'll say, we changed the rule again, and now it's another bajillion dollars.
Wade, you said that you thought that they just way, way, way underestimated at the beginning. Is that what you're saying?
Well, for right of way, yeah. The original estimate was $435,000. That doesn't buy much right of way.
I think also we were expecting these costs.
Yes.
We've been expecting these costs for some time. So this is just authorization to pay these costs that were anticipated. We do have the option once we get design to look for outside sources of funding. That could be a tall order right now, but that is an option. Once we have the preliminary design done, we don't have to build.
I would certainly recommend we finish out the design and get approval on that at a bare minimum. We'll be at what they call a design acceptance package next month. Have a workshop on it. So we're close to everyone agreeing to the design accesses, things like that. That's a big step.
Additional comments? Eric?
So I wanted to echo Mark's comments, and there were, I actually saw on Facebook today, there were a number of citizens that were, that this caught their attention, and they were thinking that the city somehow was asleep at the switch in cost estimating. And I just want to make sure here on in our public meeting that this, the people understand that that we're dealing with a part of our city that is under the control of ODOT, and ODOT has requested some changes, and that has resulted in this. So we are doing our best to operate within the reality that we have, which is this road is on ODOT, and some things that have changed within ODOT to then have these costs come our way. And when Rachel was talking about we've been anticipating these costs, I think what you're referring to, Rachel, is we've been anticipating this after they told us it was coming. We didn't anticipate it in the beginning when we did the IGA. So we're doing the best we can there. And I know Wade's been working really hard on that. So thank you. But yeah, I think I like the idea of completing the design. I mean, the other thing we have to realize with COVID and the state being tied to the income tax, who knows what the next wave is going to be where they pull back funding. Because that happened on this, I understand. They pulled back funding as part of the problem in addition to increasing some of the requirements for the construction. So I am concerned that this is not the final shift toward us. And I want to make, as much as we need the signal on Cascade, we have to be able to afford it before we commit to build it. So if I'm hearing from Wade that there's an option to finish the design without necessarily committing to construction under these prices, that sounds reasonable.
That's accurate, Council.
But by the time we get to construction, ODOT really won't have any money left into it. So I mean, they've front-loaded their spending. So they've spent almost $500,000 and we've spent $56,000. It starts turning around with the right-of-way phase. And by the time we get to construction, it's all on the city.
So if we got this design done and then decided that we just didn't have the money, like let's say for 5 years to get it built, could ODOT come back and say, oh, well now we have different ideas about the design. You guys have to add some fancier ramps.
I think we know that's a yes.
That's what happened.
Getting to the design acceptance package is a big milestone to help prevent that. But we all know that ADA requirements change yearly. So yeah, there's always a potential of an ADA change.
But they wouldn't say, oh, we changed our mind and you really need to go back to 80 feet on the north side, or?
No, I don't believe so. That being the local road, we have a little bit more say on the design vehicle for the turn onto and Wasco.
As much as we don't want to make a motion, would anyone make a motion? I guess let's put it that way. It's on page 7.
On tonight's consent agenda, we authorize the city manager to sign the purchase order to ODOT to increase the city's share of preliminary engineering to $514,523.53 and increase the city's share of the right-of-way cost to $807,261 $1.47 for Cascade and Rand traffic intersection.
Just a comment, we're on the regular meeting now. That's been an error.
We need to just strike that portion.
Strike the portion about about it being on the consent agenda because we are in regular meeting. Okay. So I have a motion by Councillor Cunahan.
I will second, but I am annoyed.
Thank you, Megan. And I have a second by Councillor Saunders. Additional discussion. Okay.
Mayor, it sounds like this is a full approval for the whole thing. This isn't the idea of just approving the design.
This is design and construct, or design and right-of-way acquisition.
And acquisition. So it's more than design. It's the land purchase?
Yes.
And do we have a discussion of where this money's coming from?
It's the road STCs.
Okay. Do we have an option to spend less and just do the design? Or someone had mentioned that. That wasn't the motion, but is that an option?
Yes, I believe so.
So we have a motion and a second on the table.
Now to do right-of-way acquisition on a state highway would require ODOT to perform that at any time. There are no local agencies that are certified to enter into right-of-way negotiations for ODOT. So if that were put off, it would still have to go through the state.
So the right-of-way question, the right-of-way acquisition that's been negotiated by ODOT, this includes our portion of it. If we didn't do this now and they didn't purchase the right-of-way now, in a year or two, that right-of-way acquisition might have to be renegotiated and the price could be different.
Yes.
More or less.
And it would still,
I mean, we don't know.
It would still have to be done through an agreement with ODOT.
So we have to deal with them regardless for the right of way.
Actually, be coming back to council within 2 to 3 months with a more of a right of way acquisition services agreement, which is not monetary. It's just this is the monetary part. But once they wrap up the design, we'll need a resolution for them to move forward with acquisition.
I think this acquisition of right of way has been a big stumbling block for quite some time. And I think it would be prudent to get through that part of it because it's negotiated now. ODOT's got it negotiated and things could change.
They haven't gone into negotiations yet.
They haven't? How do they know? How do they know the amount?
They know. As soon as this, assuming the design acceptance package goes through, they know the areas and they know, you know, square footage costs and all the, and they're basing it on that and on potential negotiations. So
on potential negotiations.
Right. Right. They tried to err on the high end. We'll see.
To make sure there's going to be enough.
Yes.
Okay. So we have a motion and we have a second still on the table. We're still in discussion. Any more comments before we vote?
Madam Mayor, could I just ask a quick question? I I'm a little nervous about it. If you probably can tell from my questions, I know we're about ready to hit our budget cycle generally, and then we have the COVID overlay. I guess I'm hearing a strong staff recommendation to proceed, but I guess given the financial situation the city may be going in some, we got all this money, and I guess what we do with it will mean we won't have it for something else potentially. I guess I wouldn't mind just Rachel or Will, I guess, just feeling good about telling us they feel good about the source of these funds.
Yeah, at this point, this is still the same. Oh, I didn't see Will was okay. Sorry, Will. At this point, this is the number that we have in the budget, and the funds are there. We should have a conversation about the construction cost when we get it. In light of the high cost, not to mention what might be happening with state funds, but the $1.3 million number is already in the budget. That said, there's no reason why we couldn't. It's perfectly reasonable to stop at design now and then look at right away when we bring the agreement to you, if that makes council more comfortable. Will, anything you want to add on the budget?
I would only add that we also have STP cash mat or cash swap funds that we haven't accessed, and we have about $800,000 that have accumulated in state funds that are then swapped for state funds. And I've got a informal approval that this project would be eligible for that. So that's just one additional place, and we could, you know, we can't use that money for any other purpose in the budget. Other than some of these projects. So it'd be good use, and I think it could lessen the demand, the fiscal demand on the road fund. So happy to talk more about that during budget as well.
So are you saying this money, you're talking about the 800,000, are you saying that money could be used for part of this 1,321,000, or do you mean for construction later?
Wade, can you help on we just generally have a head nod, or I have an email saying we can use that on this project. I don't have it to the specificity of the specific stage, but we're going to be working with our new employee, Rich, who filled a long vacancy in our engineering projects in there, and work with him to figure out where we can apply that money. But it's something that you see it in the budget every year, STP funds, and we just end up not having a project get to the place where we can use some. So I just wanted to bring that up, that it's accumulation, about 800,000, that you don't even see in our budget because the state holds on to it for us. And it's just one way that I think we could apply this to be a little less burdensome on the road fund.
Yeah, I don't know if that's limited to construction dollars or not.
I don't think that it is, but I don't want to be on the record right now on what part of the phase, if it is regulated to a certain phase in the project.
So I guess the question is, if we approve this motion that we have on the table still, can we still find out and use those other funds for a swap if possible, even though we would approve this motion? Or do you need a different motion if we were going to do that?
No, I think we'll be fine.
Okay. We're good with this motion.
Hey, Kate.
Mark?
I think it's important, and this is Eric's question and asking staff to confirm. This is road fund money paid with STC funds, and it cannot be used for COVID. It cannot be used for general fund. This is road money, and there's a misunderstanding in the community that all the money is the same, and they are different buckets that have different purposes, and this is not us wasting money here where we could be spending it somewhere else.
Craig, the only other place it could go is other SDC eligible projects, but nothing that I could imagine would have any nexus to COVID.
or revenue replacement. You know, this is not a replacement for transient room tax revenue.
It's roads.
Yeah. It's roads.
Mm-hmm. So if we didn't use it for this road project, it would have to be used for a different road project. And this is the highest need of a road project in our city at this time. This one's number one, and Second Anoka's are number two.
Yep, I would agree with that.
Okay, if we don't have more discussion, I think we should vote. Councillor Mehta?
Aye.
Councillor Zan Miller?
The most reluctant yes I've ever
Councillor Cunahan?
I second that, and I say aye.
Councillor Haney?
Nay.
Councillor Rivera?
Aye.
Councillor Saunders?
Yes.
And chair votes aye. All right. We have authorization. You're welcome. Department heads. We had a little bit from both of the chiefs earlier, but Chief Holstead, do you have anything?
I don't have anything.
Okay. Chief Damien?
Nor do I.
Okay. I don't see Dustin here, so. Reports from committees. Visitor Advisory Committee. Jessica and Megan?
Yes, so both of us actually missed the last meeting, which was mostly about website discovery. But been chatting with Ashley, the director of Visit Hood River, and obviously all the coronavirus stuff. This is not a great time for that group and most of its members. But Visit Hood River, along with the chamber, has obviously been a very strong partner in getting the message out of we are currently closed to visitors. Along with all the other regional partners. So super appreciative of Ashley and those folks on that. They have also been working with their members to try and, provide some support during all of this. Definitely working on whenever we get to a point of it is safe to invite visitors back, trying to, they're working on figuring out the plan of how you then ramp some stuff back up to welcome folks back and hopefully bring some much needed support for businesses at that time. But like the rest of us, everything is in development and we'll see where it all goes. But if anyone has questions, I'll try to answer them.
I'll share just like a points of information that I had heard from Travel Oregon. Is one is that they have seen an uptick of people looking to travel in late August, and that rural Oregon is high on the list of places where people are looking to travel because it is seen as a safer place.
Okay. Mayor call. I've been on the emergency operation center calls, and I think some of you listened to the information that came down from the governor about reopening through Nate Stice. And so the county is working on that, as Rachel had talked about. I don't have much else to add. I'm going to do the radio tomorrow morning. Usually they do it on Monday. We talk about what we're going to be talking about. But I assume he'll be asking, what did we talk about last night? So I'll be doing that tomorrow morning. So I'll do council call next. Tim?
Nothing really to add here other than to continue to say that I'm proud of our community for stepping up and doing the right thing. There is this proclamation. Were you going to read that, Kate?
Yes.
Okay. So I assume you just do that at the end, or you can do it now.
I'll do that. We'll do the rest of the council call, okay. And then I'll do that. Thank you for bringing it to us, though.
Yeah. You're welcome.
Councillor Haney?
Thank you, Mayor. I'll just say briefly two things. First item on the meeting dealing with the opening of the parks, I really commend council and I commend the city manager for taking that through. I think that'll be a positive first step to the new normal. So thank you for that. And then I'll also mention this past Thursday, we had the mayor and Councillor Zan Miller and myself address the Rotary Club. And I just want to thank you two for doing that. I thought the mayor had a really nice discussion that I think was well received by the group. So it was also kind of a different format where we were fielding questions directly from people real time. So it was just another way to interface with the community. And I just, as a Rotarian, I thank both of you for participating.
Thank you for inviting us. Councilor Rivera?
Nothing to add. Just to continue reminding folks to stay home if they possibly can, if they're going out in public, to ensure that they're wearing a mask. Don't touch your mask or your face, your eyes or your nose. Wash your hands for 20 seconds. This is going to be the new norm for a little bit, and I'd rather be safe than sorry. So please just continue taking every precaution to keep yourself and your family safe during this time.
Thanks, Gladys. Councillor Mehta?
I will say that we had the, Governor Brown was on the call that the weekly call I've been facilitating with all the economic development and workforce partners last Friday, and was great. We had a good discussion with Trish Elliott was there. To talk about what our public health providers will need for the reopening framework. I do know, as I mentioned, that the state is working on guidance for specific sectors on how they can reopen. So daycares, retail, and restaurants are at the top of the list. But we've heard it's really gonna be all those things that Councilor Rivera really just said. I think that's all the news to share right now.
Thank you. Councillor Zan Miller?
I was going to make some silly joke about the font size of this proclamation being too small, but I think that the important thing is, you know, these are serious times, and what Gladys and Jessica said are so absolutely critical, and Eric and Megan and Tim as well, that we as a council are, you know, trying to listen to experts and trying to provide the best advice so that we can be as safe as possible getting through this thing, and it's the biggest job we have, so, and staff, you're doing awesome. So good job.
I do want to add one last piece. Sorry, Megan. And this is serious. I only mention it just because I've seen instances where something similar has happened. So I really do want to mention it. Do not inject Clorox or Lysol. Consider doing so. The medical term for that is called embalming. Please do not consider this as an option to treat or prevent coronavirus COVID-19.
Councillor Saunders?
I don't think I have anything to add. Definitely seconding everyone else's statements on everything coronavirus related. So thanks, everyone.
Okay, thanks. So Tim brought this to us, and it's Older Americans Month 2020, a proclamation. I think I qualify for this now, so yes, it's applicable. Whereas Hood River, Oregon includes a growing number of older Americans who enrich our community through their diverse life experiences. And whereas the city of Hood River is committed to strengthening our community by connecting with and supporting older adults, their families, and caregivers, and acknowledging their many valuable contributions to society. And whereas the city of Hood River recognizes the importance of bringing together all generations and engaging in activities that promote physical, mental, and emotional well-being for the benefit of all. And whereas Hood River can enhance the lives of older Americans in our community by promoting home and community-based services that support independent living, involving older Americans in community events and other activities, and providing opportunities for older adults to work, volunteer, learn, lead, and mentor. Now, therefore, we of Hood River, Oregon, do hereby proclaim May 2020 to be Older Americans Month. We urge every resident to take time during this month to recognize older adults and the people who serve them as essential and valuable members of our community. Good thing to be remembering. Thank you for bringing that to us, Tim. All right. We are adjourned. We will see you all Wednesday for budget meeting at 6 o'clock. Is that right, Rachel? 6 p.m. All right. We'll see you Wednesday.
That's good night.
Thanks.
Yep. We're adjourned.